This is Guns and Butter.
Something's happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter is a live fundraiser for KPFA. On today's show, we will be airing excerpts from a two-hour narrated interview with CIA operative and mob associate Chauncey Holt, who unveils the conspiracy that changed America's future, the film Spooks, Hoods, and the Hidden Elite. The first-person story of how the secret government orchestrated the assassination of President Kennedy by someone who was a participant in that secret operation. We are offering both the two-hour narrated interview with Chauncey Holt, as well as his 608-page book, Self-Portrait of a Scoundrel. We are also fortunate to have joining us live today JFK assassination researcher, author, McKnight Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota at Duluth, and founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, Dr. James Fetzer. Jim, are you with us?
Hey, Bonnie, I'm delighted to be here, especially because due to an unusual set of circumstances, I actually got to know Chauncey Marvin Holt personally. He was the third of the three tramps photographed in Dealey Plaza that day. The last of the three, the oldest with a hat carrying a paper bag in which he had a specially designed handgun and radio equipment. He's been confused with E. Howard Hunt, but it was indeed Chauncey Marvin Holt. And, you know, he has a fascinating story to tell.
Well, Jim, remarkably, you knew Chauncey Holt and can attest to his authenticity as a primary source for the JFK assassination plot. Isn't that right?
That's exactly right. In fact, Chauncey was working as a contract agent for the CIA at the Los Angeles Stamp and Stationery Store, a five-story building. They had four floors with a legitimate business. The CIA was running its ID operation on the top floor. The lower floors, interestingly, produced police and sheriff identification. So if the CIA actually needed some for one of their operatives, they could get real, not just fake, ID for police and sheriff's officials. He was instructed by his handler, Philip Twombly, to prepare 15 sets of Ford Secret Service credentials to be used in and around Dealey Plaza that day. He worried that he might not get the color-coded pins that the agents wear from change to day to day, but he got them in time, and he took them to Dealey Plaza, and there's more to the story to add as we proceed.
Well, thank you, Jim. Let's get right into the beginning of this remarkable interview with Chauncey Holt, who was one of the three tramps, as you pointed out, picked up in Dealey Plaza, Dallas, on November 22nd, 1963. This first track is a good introduction to Chauncey Holt and his remarkable life.
Are known only as the Three Tramps.
There's snapping pictures right about,
about here.
This is Chauncey Holt, a career criminal now living in California. Holt claims that he is this man, the tramp in the hat. His story is fantastic.
Chauncey Marvin Holt, a longtime contract agent for the Central Intelligence Agency and a mafia associate. You're about to see the interview conducted with Mr. Holt just 8 days before he died. This is his story.
people know the incestuous relationship that you know, existed and probably exists at the moment between these various very powerful elements, organized crime, intelligence community, the political and powerful business interests. I felt that the American public had a right to know as many of the details that I have available. I grew up in Southern Kentucky where bootlegging was a way of life. You know, it's probably the most important crop, just like marijuana is in certain counties now. And it was nothing unusual about bootlegging because when the Scotch-Irish immigrants came to Kentucky in the early part of the 17th century, they brought their stills with them. And whiskey making was one of their skills, and they always did it.
For the young Chauncey, there was no stigma attached to being a bootlegger.
Not only, distilled the whiskey, what we delivered it, usually to somewhere like Knoxville, Tennessee, which is close, about 40 miles, and as far away as Cincinnati.
Chauncey Holt got around, and getting around got him in trouble. He ended up in reform school in Chillicothe, Ohio.
Now they have prisons for youthful offenders. That was what it would have been in those days. But they called it a reform school. And I'd been in there railroaded by the FBI for joyriding in a car. That was Hoover's big thing in those days, was catching youthful car thieves. Usually someone else caught them, and they took the credit. And although we were right in the middle of the war, I mean, Hoover took the time to send wire after wire down to Louisville wanting to know why we hadn't been prosecuted. Gives you an idea of what importance he placed on those type things.
This teletype, April 23rd, 1942, from Hoover to FBI Louisville office says, in part, Chauncey Marvin Holt et al. Advised by return teletype status prosecution of this case. In the event final prosecution complete, submit report immediately reflecting results of prosecution. It's signed Hoover.
While I was there, I met several people that were connected with organized crime. So he said, I'll put you in touch with these guys in Baltimore who work hand in glove with Marlansky. One was Cy Bloom and his brother Morris. Cy Bloom handled all the bookmaking operations for Lansky in the Baltimore area. And it was through that connection that he came down to Lansky came down to Baltimore to visit with Cy Bloom and to see his son Buddy Lansky, who at that time was in the Phipps Clinic. He was disabled. He's in the Phipps Clinic, and I knew him. I had gotten acquainted with him, with Buddy, and we used to go and play chess with him, that sort of thing, because I was doing some painting work for the restoring a painting right across the street.
Chauncey Holt's skills as a painter would serve him well. A Renaissance man, he developed other skills. He became an arms expert in the military, as well as learning how to fly an airplane. Holt also did another kind of flying, but not inside a cockpit.
My uncle, by marriage, owned a small one-ring circus. And from the time I was 6 years old, I mean, I was running up and down the tight wire, you know, swinging on the trapeze. I worked in this family circus, and I did a single trapeze act. I worked in a flying act. I did a low wire act, a high wire act, shot from the cannon, all that sort of thing, you know.
The circus performer in Chauncey Holt thought getting shot out of a cannon was a hell of a lot safer and easier than getting shot at. Chauncey's Baltimore connection with Meyer Lansky would lead to a long relationship with the mobster and other important mob figures, including the head of the Detroit family, Peter Licavoli.
I did a little work for him in painting. He sent some paintings over to me to be restored, and that started a relationship with Licavoli that lasted 50 years. It lasted from 44 until the date of his death in 1984. I had a lot of other qualities that they liked. First of all, I was a pilot. Secondly, I was a very good shooter. I was a weapons expert. And of course, the art didn't help. It didn't hurt because it extended to forgery if necessary. And of course, I was a very good accountant, very good money manager, and probably I did more money managing and more fiscal type work down through the years than I did the other types of work.
Chauncey's math skills, he was brilliant with figures, caught Meyer Lansky's attention.
So Lansky was coming down to Baltimore to see Buddy, and he was going to, check up on the operation there, the bookmaking operation, and Seibloom called me. I was working in a shipyard. He called me and asked me if I'd like to come over and meet Meyer Lansky. So he told Meyer Lansky that I was a mathematical genius. Well, I may have seemed like a mathematical genius to him, but anyway, so Lansky came in, and we're talking, and it turned out that he was like me in the sense that he used to work a mathematical problem just like he'd work a crossword puzzle. He'd get a book with nothing but problems in, mostly algebraic problems. So he said, I want to work out this little problem for you, and you show me the fallacy in it, because you start out with a premise, and you end up, and it looks like 2 = 1. So we go down through these equations, and it started out with A = B. Well, down in the middle of this computation, you divide by A - B. Well, if A = B, A - B is 0. So I pointed it out, and I said, there's a fallacy. And he said, that's right. He says, anything divided by 0, the answer is 0. And so I said, told him that, well, technically he was wrong for the simple reason that the answer is not 0, it's infinity. And so he was very, very impressed. And he said, now, if you ever come down to Florida, I've thought about coming to Florida after the war. He says, if you come down to Florida, he said, be sure and look me up. You can tutor me in analytical differential integral calculus subject he was interested in. So I knew that I'd made a very, very valuable connection.
Chauncey Holt got a close-up and a personal look at one of the most powerful members of organized crime.
Lansky, although he had a very violent past, having been, a member of the Bugs and Meyer gang, and he could be as ruthless as the next person, and he could, getting what he wanted. However, he was extremely intelligent. He was polite. He was very low key. He was compassionate. Many things that you don't find in the average gangster. He never actually thought of himself as a gangster. Although to do that, you'd have to exclude his early life, because he just considered himself simply a gambler who was providing the public with something that they begged for. Well, I knew him from starting in 44. I knew him until he went to Israel. As a matter of fact, I had a short letter from him just before he went to Israel saying he had decided to go to Israel and live.
Lansky writes to Marvin Holt in a letter dated May 25th, 1970. Dear Marvin, I have decided to go and live in Israel. I will be here at Ray's for a few days. Ray's is Ray Ryan's El Mirador Hotel in Palm Springs. The letter goes on to say, I would like to see you before I go. Fly down here if you can. I don't dare come to L.A. If I don't get to see you before we leave, I want to thank you for the past favors. Keep your nose clean. I will write you from Israel if I don't get to see you. Your friend, Meyer. Blansky wanted to migrate to Israel, but was having difficulties entering the country. Like the letter he wrote to Chauncey, Lansky's personal appeal to the Prime Minister of Israel is also handwritten. Lansky tells Menachem Begin he wants very much to live in Israel and blames his image problems on the media. Chauncey became acquainted with another notorious crime figure, the man many say created a gambling oasis in the Nevada desert, Bugsy Siegel.
So soon after I, after the war, I went south and hooked up with the with Lansky. Started working for his organization. I worked for his main accounting firm, and I also was office manager of one of his front organizations, which was used for a lot for stock manipulations and that sort of thing. And I also worked at the Colonial Inn, which was the plushest of the carpet joints there in Florida at that time.
The Colonial Inn in Hollandale, Florida was a hot spot. Show business types, mobsters, and politicians flocked to the glamorous gambling nightclub resort. It was Lansky's prototype for Las Vegas gambling and casinos. All the while, Holt was privy to the Lansky Las Vegas Bugsy Siegel connection.
Actually, I met him actually before they started the Flamingo. The first trip that I made west with him to meet Siegel, he was going out because Siegel wanted him to go into buying the El Cortez Hotel.
On their first trip to Las Vegas, Lansky told Holt he wasn't worried about J. Edgar Hoover. The mob had compromising photos of the FBI director and his aide, Clyde Tolson, taken at the Del Charro Lodge in La Jolla, California. The mob was worried about Siegel's mishandling their money in Las Vegas.
The Brotherhood would put up $6 million. They were beginning to get concerned about their money. So we went out to talk to Siegel again and to look into the rumors that he and Virginia Hill had been squirreling away money for their retirement. So we went out and we talked to all the vendors and so forth. This principal one was the general contractor was Dale Webb, and we talked to him and we discovered at once that Siegel, well, he hadn't paid Dale Webb nearly as much money as he said. So it was obvious that he was stealing. So we came back. And shortly after that, they had a big meeting in Havana when all the everybody, every top mob figure in the country, but Lucky Luciano came from Italy, came to Havana to have a conference about what they were going to do about Lansky, about Siegel. Lansky pleaded for him, you know, said, hey, look, well, you know, he served us long and well. Why don't we give him just a little piece of the action and let him get out? And it came back, so he said, okay. So Lansky and I made another trip to California. And he told Lansky and I, right to our face, that, you know, we could shove it. That the Flamingo was his and he was keeping it and that was that. Because he had a violent, violent, uncontrollable temper. And so as far as that went, I mean, that was his death warrant.
That conversation was on 19th of June, 1947. A day later, Siegel was dead.
On the 20th, we followed Siegel around all day to the barber shop, to his lawyer. He went over to a place on Fountain Avenue to meet a girlfriend. You know, he didn't seem like he had a worry in the world.
Siegel was murdered, 3 shots to the head. Chauncey denied any involvement in the actual murder of Siegel. He didn't pull the trigger, he swears, but He hints at his role at Lookout performing surveillance for the mob hitmen. He never denies his relationship with another important crime figure.
Peter Licavoli was one of the most important organized crime figures in the country. He was probably the last of a dying breed. He grew up in St. Louis, a big Sicilian family. He was imported by the Purple Gang into Detroit in the early 30s to act as enforcers. Then they finally took over, and he became one of five ruling dons of Detroit. The Detroit operated differently than, say, New York. New York had five separate families headed by five separate people. They had one family that was headed by five ruling dons, of which one was Peter Licavoli. He was into everything. I mean, he was into loan sharking, and he was into anything that prostitution, anything that that the mob is normally, involved in. And he had a really a great love for art, and he was a sucker when it came to buying art, especially Italian art. He loved buying Italian art. And we used to buy that stuff by the roomful, of course he was trying to clean up his image, and he was a competent painter. I have some of his paintings.
You're listening to the voice of Chauncey Holt, the first-person story of how the secret government orchestrated the assassination of President Kennedy. This is a two-hour DVD, Spooks, Hoods, and the Hidden Elite, which is one of our thank you gifts today on KPFA for a pledge of $100. I'll have to say, this DVD is really too much. It's unbelievably good. 2 hours in length with lots of documentation, pictures from the time of, etc. Spooks, Hoods, and the Hidden Elite. Give us a call to pledge your support for KPFA. $100 for this incredible DVD. 1-800-439-5732. 5732. Of course, I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. We're coming to you live today on KPFA, and we are delighted to have JFK assassination expert Jim Fetzer on the line with us. What did you think of all of that, Jim?
Well, of course, it's fascinating stuff, and I can vouch for Chauncey's authenticity. In fact, I was originally taped to be the introduction and the closing segments of the program, but there was a falling out between the producers and Chauncey's daughter, Karen, which led me to withdraw permission for them to use it. But I'm thoroughly familiar with Chauncey and his work, his manuscripts. I've read them. Not the bound edition of the book you have, but in manuscript form. He's an extraordinarily good writer. The guy was a genius. I mean, you're hearing him talk at the very end of his career. He was, I believe, then 75 years old. I conducted a symposium in 2000 in Dallas, where I've chaired or co-chaired five national conferences on the identity of the third tramp. And I invited his daughter, Karen, to participate, and she proved to be very adept at doing superpositions over images using photos from the family album. So that, for example, Jerry Rose, who was from one of the New York State colleges and the editor of the third decade, later the fourth decade, a journal of JFK assassination research, spoke at the end and said, well, he'd always believed that it was E. Howard Hunt, and after watching Karen's presentation, he was now convinced, in fact, it had been Chauncey Marvin Holt. And the fact is that, Bonnie, here you have one of the unique opportunities to hear someone deep on the inside. He is completely sincere. I mean, this is utterly authentic, everything he's reporting. You're not going to get this from anyone else. It's really a guy who has a massive experience with the mob, massive experience with the CIA. He was even at one point in time Meyer Lansky's accountant because Meyer was so impressed with Chauncey's point about division by zero, that it's not actually zero but infinity, because there are infinitely many nothings in something. I mean, it's a really, truly astonishing story, and I think that your audience needs to appreciate that this guy, Chauncey Marvin Holt, was a real deal, and they'll learn more about how the American government actually works from reading and watching his presentation than from any other source they could ever imagine.
Well, thank you, Jim. I totally agree. I've watched the two-hour DVD twice now, and I'm going to watch it again. It's absolutely fascinating. And Chauncey, of course, is a primary source for the assassination of President Kennedy. And I'm glad you mentioned his book. I have it right in front of me. This is our second thank you gift today on KPFA, Self-Portrait of a Scoundrel, written by Chauncey Holt. And Jim Fetzer can attest to what a brilliant writer Chauncey is. This is a 600-page book. Self-Portrait of a Scoundrel is the memoir of CIA contract agent and underworld figure Chauncey Marvin Holt as he operated in the twilight world of bootlegging, bookmaking, gun running, money laundering, espionage, and assassinations using secret identities while serving many masters. Holt's amazing story chronicles his participation in top-secret black operations conducted during the Cold War and reveals his clandestine role in the events surrounding the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And, of course, when we get to Dealey Plaza, that's a good hour and a half into the DVD, so we're not going to be able to hear that audio today, but I'm sure that Jim Fetzer, a little later, can fill us in on Dealey Plaza because he's intimately familiar with this operation. $75 donation to KPFA, and we can get you Chauncey's 608-page book, Self-Portrait of a Scoundrel. So that's $75 for the book, $100 for the two-hour DVD. You can get them both for a tax-deductible contribution of $160 to KPFA by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or securely online at kpfa.org. A couple of people have already called in. I'd like to thank Claire Fetter from Atherton. Thank you, Claire. Also, Chris Date in Healdsburg. Thank you, Chris. Chris, a big supporter of KPFA and Guns and Butter. 1-800-439-5732. Well, Jim Fetzer and I can both personally attest for the quality of these this book, this DVD. Chauncey Holt, you know, I knew nothing about this when I went to Dallas late last month, actually, and Chris Milligan of Trine Day, who has published this stuff, gave me the stuff, and it was a revelation to me. It's an incredible story. Spooks, Hoods, and the Hidden Elite is a DVD for $100, $75 for his lovely book, Self-Portrait of a Scoundrel by Chauncey Holt, 1-800-439-5732. Well, Jim, before we get back into some more of the audio, I guess what's coming up then is Chauncey's involvement with Operation Mongoose and the Bay of Pigs and Meyer Lansky, etc. What else can you tell us about Chauncey?
Well, he told me the story about, you know, being directed to prepare 15 sets of forged Secret Service credentials for use in and around Dealey Plaza by his handler, Philip Twombly. And how he worried about getting the color-coded pins in time, which he did. He was directed to deliver them to a red pickup truck parked behind the grassy knoll. Most Americans don't realize that was a parking lot for the Dallas Police Department. When he arrived there, the truck wasn't present, so he wandered around Dealey Plaza. He told me he saw more hitmen, more assassinations and bad guys than you'd find at a Soldiers of Fortune convention. He went back and the truck was there, so he left the documents. He'd been instructed to proceed with a person he knew as Richard Montoya and another he knew as Charles Harrelson, the father of actor Woody, to a boxcar in the railroad yard behind the parking area where they'd find a boxcar that would appear to be locked but actually would not be. They climbed in and found it was loaded with weapons, explosives, ammunition. They thought they got away when the train started to pull out, but the manager of the yard thought something was wrong, pulled it back in. They were arrested, walked through Dealey Plaza, described as the three tramps, though they're obviously not tramps. The first of the three, he knew as Richard Montoya. His actual name is Charles Rogers, very well-dressed. There's a book about him called The Man on the Grassy Knoll. The second, Charles Harrelson, a hitman for the mob. He would be eventually indicted and convicted for the murder of a federal judge with a high-powered rifle, a crime rather analogous to the taking out of JFK. And then the third of the three wearing the hat and the paper bag with his special custom-made handgun and radio equipment, Chauncey himself. It's really remarkable that you have someone who is this deeply embedded in these events who's willing to come forward and risk his life. Chauncey actually even ran a school for assassins at one point in time. At least two contracts were put out on him, but the other guy came up on the short end of the stick. Chauncey died not long after this. He was actually murdered in a hospital by the CIA to silence him permanently. He was in bed, which is a very dangerous place to be because they know exactly where you are. Someone posing as a doctor came in and gave him, through his IV drip, a massive blood thinner. He wound up bleeding internally, swelled up like a tomato. I mean, it was an awful end for a really remarkable guy.
Oh, wow, Jim, I didn't know that. Thank you so much for saying that, because they announce all through the, well, at least in the beginning and the end of this two-hour interview with Chauncey, that he died 8 days after this recorded interview. So I didn't realize he had been murdered. So thank you so much for that. We want to get back to the second track, but I'd like to get some more people to call in and support KPFA at 1-800-439-5732, $100 for this incredible DVD, a $75 pledge for his brilliant book, Self-Portrait of a Scoundrel. You can get both the book and the DVD for $160. 1-800-439-5732 or online at kpfa.org.
It was during the Kefauver Committee hearings into organized crime that Chauncey's career took a turn. Meyer Lansky had been ordered to testify.
He was one of the few guys that didn't end up in jail, because most of them ended up in jail because of contempt of Congress. But he got up there and he answered all their questions. And he appeared first without a lawyer, then he had his lawyer. But, he was quick on his feet.
Chauncey is quick, too, immediately accepting an offer of a unique job offered him by Lansky. The year is 1953.
I can put you in a job. If you want to have a job, I could put you in over here at the International Rescue Committee as a controller at a real good salary. I thought it was a philanthropic organization, like the Red Cross or something, like the name implies. They like those innocuous names of the CIA. So I was sitting there when a guy walked in from Washington. His name was Richard Sluter, came in, and he explained to me the facts of life, that this was a proprietary interest of the CIA.
Chauncey's aliases were many. He would use 25 different names while working for the mob and the CIA.
We had two types of aliases. We had floating aliases that more than one agent used, and a number of agents used over the years that you'd just slap a picture on. Now, I used Charles Hormley, Robert Ralston, Marvin Hoyt, which is not too far from my own name. However, as far as deep cover agents aliases went, I had three deep cover agents that would withstand the vigorous scrutiny. One was the one that I used the longest time, was John R. Moon. I used Kearney L. Sigler, and I used Dean Rutz.
The CIA hadn't been in business too long, but already had a clear target, Guatemala. Chauncey assumed a new identity. and began training for his mission at a secret CIA base in Arizona.
So I became Robert Ralston, and I had all these credentials in that name. So I went out to Aranya, which is a big base. Well, it became an awful big base later. It wasn't much of a base in those years. It was right near Tucson that the CIA used. It was a training facility. And I went out to get some multi-engine training because in preparation for going down to Guatemala.
Chauncey's personal records include copies of CIA contract agent paperwork. This type of supporting documentation involving a CIA contract agent has never been made public before.
I first went to Guatemala as a part of a five-man assassination team, I guess you'd call us, that went down to figure what we're going to do. It looked like that our Benz was going to win the next year's election, and we were trying to get a CIA-approved candidate to run against him.
But the plan was a failure, and our Benz remained in power.
So here we were with this guy who was an out-and-out communist sitting there. At that time, Eisenhower, Dulles, and those guys all up and down the line said, you know, this guy's got to go. So we found another guy who was in prison down there, and his name is Casilio Armas, and he was educated in the United States. He had gone to the command and general staff school at Leavenworth and so forth. He's caught in a coup, and they sentenced him to death, and he was in jail. So we went down and got the guy out of jail, which was very easy. All we did was just grease a few palms, and he walked right out into a limousine. You know, it wasn't a 007 type deal, you know.
Armas, backed with a 300-man army and the CIA, invaded Guatemala from Nicaragua.
I was flying a C-47, and we used we had a C-47 because we could either push ordnance out the door, or we could actually use it for leaflets. And of course, we were flying over Guatemala City, just distributing those leaflets for our Benz to give up and so forth. And which he did. He threw in the sponge in August. He fled the country, and of course, then Eisenhower was able to say that Guatemala was now back in the hands of the people.
Even while working for the CIA, Chauncey continued to work for organized crime.
I always kept in touch. And if Meyer Lansky or any of his group wanted something of me, they certainly would. They didn't hesitate to ask me. When Castro landed up in Escambray Mountains and started his little revolution, he got some aid from Lansky, simply because Lansky was just sort of hedging his bet. As a matter of fact, he had an agreement with Castro that if he took over the government, he'd let him continue operating the casinos. After Castro actually came to power in 1959, he let them operate for about 2 months, and then he confiscated the hotels, and so naturally they were interested in getting back to Cuba. Lansky himself, personally, had a $1 million contract out on Castro. So here we had these people, and then we had the CIA, and we had the mob, all trying to get rid of Castro.
Cuba wasn't the only interest. So was the Dominican Republic and its dictator, Rafael Trujillo.
The government was pushing very, very vigorously to get rid of Castro, and they had enlisted the aid of Trujillo and Johnny Abbas, who was his head of security, who was one of the best assassins in the world. But they suddenly, somewhere in the about this time, the State Department decided, hey, we've had enough of Trujillo. Trujillo has to go, so we're going to. So they started putting plans in the hopper to kill Trujillo. So that removed one very, very dangerous foe of Castro.
A CIA letter dated March 17, 1961, sent to a CIA team, including Chauncey, says, in case you plan to hunt this territory, recommend high-powered foreign-made rifle with telescopic scope and silencer. Have already obtained necessary licenses and paid the fees. That means the Trujillo assassination had the go-ahead. He was murdered 2 weeks later. The mob had never forgotten how Castro had double-crossed them. So they set in motion a series of deadly plans to assassinate the Cuban leader.
Lansky had actually offered a contract of $1 million for anyone who would dispose of Castro. Now, he had a viable, in my opinion, it was the most workable plan to assassinate Castro that was ever conceived. And they had assassin chosen. They got the weapon in. It came in with some circus equipment. It was, they had rented an apartment which was within 300 yards of the television station where he used to walk back and forth and harangue for hour on end and so forth. And but at the last minute, it was called off. And it was called off through pressure from the State Department.
The CIA didn't want to give up. They wanted a location in South Florida to keep close tabs on Castro. They again turned to Meyer Lansky.
Down in the Florida Keys at Marathon had built this airport, strictly for his use, but the CIA began to use it. And we started making flights from Marathon, it wasn't too far, from Marathon into Cuba. And we would insert agents into Cuba. We would deliver arms and ammunition into Cuba. We made, literally dozens and dozens of flights into Cuba in 1960.
Intrigue, ineptitude, and infighting, CIA and State Department doomed any efforts.
Everybody seemed to be working at cross purposes, and finally, just before the 1960 election, they came up with this idea of invading Cuba, and what started out from being a very small, over-the-beach Dieppe type raid turned into a full assault.
That full assault, the Bay of Pigs invasion, would be a complete failure. A major embarrassment for the Kennedy administration and the impetus for Operation Mongoose.
Operation Mongoose was a ill-conceived operation, joint operation between organized crime and the CIA to actually simply kill Castro. And they had various memos. As a matter of fact, I have a few memos how it ended up, how they were talking about what they were going to do and so forth.
Here are some of the memos Chauncey refers to. These men participated in a meeting held at a small airport between Palm Springs and Indio, California. The name? Bermuda Dunes.
In that meeting, Peter Licavoli and I flew in from Arizona. Sam Giancana, Johnny Roselli came in from Chicago. William King Harvey came from Langley. William King Harvey was a legend in the CIA. He was the only member, he was the only CIA member there, but of course he was the one that was laying out the plan.
Who was William King Harvey? Chauncey was well aware of his involvement in other CIA operations.
William King Harvey was the head of Task Force W. That had been renamed. Originally, that was a part of ZR Rifle, operation called ZR Rifle. ZR Rifle was nothing more than an assassination group that went around the world assassinating people. And Harvey happened to be the head of ZR Rifle.
On December 14, 1961, top echelon leaders of the CIA and the Mafia met at Bermuda Dunes Airport in Palm Springs to discuss ground rules for Operation Mongoose. Chauncey's memos from that meeting show an executive action was planned. Executive action means assassination. The target, the beard, Castro. The ground rules, CIA only, maximum security, non-attributability, plausible denial, need-to-know basis. Harvey set the tone of the meeting at the Bermuda Dunes Airport.
They were going to eliminate the beard and how it was going to be done and what, just starting as to what personnel they were going to hire. First of all, they were trying to decide what cryptonym they were going to use for this, because they had decided that they would assign it a cryptonym and it would end up in the official CIA files. AM, normally operations involving Cuba had an AM start to their cryptonym. So we said, well, we don't want to use AM. What are we going to use? They started looking down the list, and MO was some cryptonym for some obscure place way out in the Pacific somewhere. So we said, hey, that would be a good use, MO. And somebody said, well, what's going to go with, what goes with MO? And so it flows, you know. So somebody said, hey, how about Mongoose? You know, the Mongoose never loses, you know. That's a good one, you know. So everybody agreed, just, hey, we'll call it Operation Mongoose.
It's also decided any further discussions about Operation Mongoose would be face-to-face, nothing in writing. The CIA's William King Harvey was clearly in charge.
It was a very short meeting because of the fact that
20 minutes an hour.
Yeah, 20 minutes an hour. It didn't take very long. I mean, he laid it out in precise terms. These guys wanted to get out, you know, and you know, take on off, and guys like Giancana and Rosselli. I mean, they're reluctant, you know, to get together. These high, and Littlevoy too, these high-ranking mobsters don't like to meet with each other, and rarely do they. So we kept it short and sweet, and that was it.
An August 14th, 1962, inter-office CIA memo from William King Harvey to the director of clandestine operations says, in part, our contract agents in Miami and Los Angeles have been assured by me that no reference to this operation appears in our central files.
You've been listening to Chauncey Holt, the first-person story of how the secret government orchestrated the assassination of President Kennedy. This is a two-hour superb DVD, an interview with Chauncey Holt, Spooks, Hoods, and the Hidden Elite for a $100 donation to KPFA. We also have a 600-page biography, Self-Portrait of a Scoundrel, for a $75 pledge, both the DVD and the book, for $160. But we need to get you on the phone. We have less than 10 minutes left. 1-800-439-5732. The pledge room has giving us a match of $600. Wendy Collins and Martinez and Patricia Castaneda in Richmond have put up $600 as a match for us to raise an equivalent amount from you, the listeners. to support KPFA, to support Guns and Butter. Of course, I'm Bonnie Faulkner. 1-800-439-5732. We don't have a lot of time to make this match, and I want to get Jim Fetzer back on to get his thoughts about the Bay of Pigs. You know, the audio that we've been able to play you this afternoon is only scratching the surface. This is only the little beginning of an incredible 2-hour DVD interview, narrated interview with Chauncey Holt 8 days before he died. And, you know, we just heard from, and I didn't know this, we just heard from Jim Fetzer that Chauncey was murdered in the hospital. Isn't that right, Jim? I was shocked to hear that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, Chauncey was a guy who they were no longer able to control. He was spilling all the secrets. He was revealing how it was done, which is why his work is so terribly important. You heard him mention William Harvey. Well, just to put that into perspective, Harvey was in charge of assassination for the CIA all over the world when E. Howard Hunt, with whom Chauncey has been so often confused in the photos of the trams, thought he was about to die. He gave his last confession to his son, St. John, whom I know personally, and he explained to him that the chain of command had gone from Lyndon Johnson to Cord Meyer to David Attlee Phillips to William Harvey to David Sanchez Morales, and then down to the shooters and the coordinators and their supervisors. I've been able to identify six of them. One was a Dallas deputy sheriff. Another was an Air Force expert. Another was a Dallas police officer. Another was a soldier of fortune. Another was Lyndon Johnson's personal hitman. But it's interesting that a shooter in the Dow Tex, who was an anti-Castro Cuban by the name of Nestor Tony Escadro, used a Mannlicher Carcano to fire three shots, which were the only unsilent shots fired, to create the acoustical impression of only three shots having been fired, was supervised by none other than George Herbert Walker Bush, who would be arrested coming out of the Dow Tex. And the whole matter supervised by Edward Lansdale, it appears. We have photographs of Lansdale walking past the three tramps. He's been identified by Fletcher Prouty and by Victor Krulak, among the most celebrated of all Marine Corps generals. We have a photograph of Bush, who, after he was questioned, was released and in front of the book depository. Third photo of Lansdale waiting to speak to Bush. So there's an awful lot going on here just beneath the surface. That last confession, by the way, was published in Rolling Stone, and you can still find it today. And St. John is talking about what he learned from his father about the assassination to this very day.
Yeah, well, that's right, Jim. Thank you for that. And a lot of the photos of Ed Lansdale, the tramps, etc., in Dealey Plaza, they are on the DVD. They're in the book. The book has a beautiful photographs. We've only got 6 minutes to go. We've got a match of $600. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. Spooks, Hoods, and the Hidden Elite, a 2-hour incredible DVD. I'm going to watch it again for the third and fourth time. For a $100 pledge today on Guns and Butter to KPFA, also his 600-page biography, Self-Portrait of a Scoundrel, incredible book by Chauncey Holt. That for $75 pledge, you can get both the DVD and the book for a $160 pledge. But the most important thing to do right now in the last 5 minutes is give us a call at 1-800-439-5732. You can also pledge securely online, which quite a few people have done at kpfa.org. I see a pledge online from Walnut Creek. Thank you. There's another one from Tempe, Arizona. Well, whoever is in Tempe, Arizona is listening online at kpfa.org. I'd like to thank a few of the people. I've got a few seconds to thank a few of you who have called in to support KPFA. Thanks to Samuel McKay in Sarasota. Thank you so much for that generous pledge. Thank you to Ronald Geese in Pleasant Hill. Thank you, Ronald. Also, thank you to Mark Smith in San Francisco. We also got a call from Catherine Miskowski in Martinez, California. Thanks to Tron Bickle in San Francisco and to Ross Laurenti in Fairfax. You can join these supporters of Guns and Butter, these supporters of KPFA, by giving us a call right now at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. I'll tell you, you're not going to find this material anywhere else except here on KPFA, or if you happen to be a fan of Chris Milligan at Fritz Milligan at Crying Day. He's the publisher. We want to support his work. And the incredible Chauncey Holt murdered, well, giving this testimony, it's incredible. I guess I shouldn't be so shocked that he got murdered 8 days before this interview. 1-800-439-5732. There are 16 chapters in this DVD. Incredible stuff. You've only heard the little beginning. There is a whole section on the guns. Jim Fetzer has mentioned the Mannlicher Carcano. That's kind of funny. We hear Chauncey had to order these $3 guns. It's a very interesting clip about the guns. He talks in detail about Oswald because he makes a trip to New Orleans, preparations for Dallas. Of course, he's there, the motorcade, the coup d'etat, run for cover. These are just some of the chapters, Scattered to the Wind, The Aftermath, and The Epilogue. And, of course, Chauncey died 8 days before giving this interview. 1-800-439-5732. We have a $600 match. We've only got a few minutes left. I'd like to get some more of you on the phone. There's somebody who's pledged online, Joseph Adler in Kensington. Thank you. You can join Joseph online at kpfa.org or give us a call at 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. And these are incredible, incredible thank you gifts. I cannot recommend them highly enough. Spooks, Hoods, and the Hidden Elite, a two-hour DVD for $100. Self-Portrait of a Scoundrel, his book, for $75. Both for $160. 1-800-439-5732. You know, the DVD begins with there's quotes from famous people that head each of these 16 chapters. And the quote from John Kennedy, well, I'd never heard this before, quote, "I know there is a God, and I see a storm coming. If he has a place for me, I am ready." Well, I never heard that quote from President John Kennedy. There's a quote from Bugsy Siegel, quote, "We only kill each other." There's another one from President Truman, quote, "The only thing new in this world is the history you don't know." Well, you can certainly find out about this history and how the world works by watching this DVD and reading his books. They're incredible. Spooks, Hoods, and the Hidden Elite, and Self-Portrait of a Scoundrel by Chauncey Holt. 1-800-439-5732.
Hello, Quincy McCoy here, General Manager of KPFA. Listen, we're under no illusions that you will always support KPFA. In this winter drive in particular, maybe only the true believers will be with us. Look, with all the bad press about Pacifica and the Empire State Building, it would be a safe bet that many of you, our listeners, may take a pass on choosing to donate this drive. My first response to this is, yeah, I can't blame you. But then on second thought, I realized, wait a minute. You should hear us out before you make that wrong decision. In this drive, like all others, we're going to be transparent about our position in all this. While Pacifica and the Empire are negotiating their way to a deal, KPFA, on the other hand, must raise the necessary funds for us to continue to do our work of speaking truth to power. That's why we need your support. That's why you should think about keeping KPFA first and keeping KPFA strong.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week and next, another in our series of classic talks by progressive political scientist Michael Parenti. This one's titled, The Hidden Ideology of the News Media. It's from 1997, and it's a keeper. I hope you'll stay tuned. Michael Parenti has been an important influence on me and on our show, New World Notes. For the past many decades, the government's official explanation of public policies seems to make no sense whatever, leaving most citizens dazed and confused. Tell me again, why did the United States invade Grenada? Why did we bomb Belgrade, Yugoslavia? Exactly how will cutting taxes for the rich create more jobs for the average American? Nothing made any sense, and the official explanation made things look murkier rather than clearer. Michael Parenti offered a new, simple, and plausible language that explained well the seemingly incomprehensible. Current events started making more sense. It would take too long to go into detail here, but take a listen to Parenti for yourself. See if his way of talking doesn't make more sense than the official explanation. As Parenti has often said, just because you don't know what they're doing doesn't mean that they don't know what they're doing. Today's talk by Parenti is titled The Hidden Ideology of the News Media. He spoke at the University of Vermont in April 1997. 25 years earlier, that university had fired him for his left-wing political activities, especially his active opposition to the Vietnam War. Now, in 1997, they were honoring him. Here is Michael Parenti.
I'm honored to welcome Michael Parenti to UVM tonight. Michael will speak on the topic, The Hidden Ideology of Mass Media. For those who do not know his work, Dr. Parenti is a nationally known lecturer and scholar, author of numerous books and articles, a political analyst, and a radical activist. I'm proud to present to you tonight, Michael Parenti. Yeah!
You. It's really, really nice to be here. Has it really been 25 years? You know, it's very depressing, isn't it, Will, that the children of your students are now your students. Isn't that right? On the other hand, it's very inspiring to know that we have another whole generation and the struggle goes on and continues. And that's what really bothers the powers that be, that they have to deal with these human beings who have thoughts and interests of their own. And that's always a problem. One of the great assets they have on their side is the media. Yes, the title is The Hidden Ideology of the News Media, or the Mass Media. It's so well hidden that the media themselves will maintain they don't have an ideology. They report only the truth. We goes out there, we gets the story, and we writes it. That's how a reporter said it to me. They have no selectivity, no biases. So you have these two basic myths. One is that it's a free and independent press. Two, it's that it's an objective press. You also have a third one, which has become a predominant one, reflective of the conservative domination of the media, namely that it's a liberal media. The idea, the charge that the media is biased in a liberal way, is well known to most Americans. The charge I'm going to make tonight that the media is biased in a right-wing corporate America way is a view not as well known. Which itself, you see, bespeaks of the bias of the media. The reason the first is so well known is because that's what the conservatives want you to know. The reason they're able to get you to know it is because they so dominate the media. They so dominate the media that they can convince you that it's the liberals who dominate the media. Did you get that? I haven't lost anybody yet, all right? It's too early in the talk to lose you now. Let's actually look at the media. One of the remarkable things about the commentators in the media is they go from far right to moderate center. You have the Rush Limbaughs, the Bob Inises, the Bob Grants, or whatever their names are, the shock jocks. You've got the McLaughlins. McLaughlin has three shows on television. Don McLaughlin, this gruff right-winger National Review editor. You have William Buckley, you have The Evening with David Brinkley, you have Evans and Novak, and others and others. You get a range of discussion that goes from far right, as I say, to a pale, skittish, centrist, moderate, liberal view, which is always kind of dressing itself up on the right. Rush Limbaugh has, for instance, 600 radio stations. Ralph Nader, who was around 25 years before Rush Limbaugh, who had done nationally known investigative work, his commentaries get on very few radio stations. He has a newspaper column he writes that gets into 20 newspapers. Conservative columnists, their columns are syndicated on an average of 200 to 450 newspapers around the country. And so that's the way it goes. There are well-financed right-wing media watch organizations. Reed Irvine. Now, Reed Irvine I've debated a couple of times on panels, and he keeps talking about liberal media and how conservative views are shut out of the media. So you've got all these conservatives all over the media talking about liberal media. And if you call up and you say, what's so liberal about it when they got people like you all over it? Actually, stations are awash with your commentaries. Irvine, for instance, I said conservative viewpoints are shut out of the media. You have a radio show that's aired on 120 stations. He said, 200. See, his ego was such that he was actually strengthening my argument when he wanted to get the right number. I said, you have a newspaper column that appears in over 90 newspapers. He says, it's 100. I said, well, there's a lot of us on the left, us liberal, progressive, left, radical, Marxist, whatever, all the various variations. A lot of us would love to be shut out in that manner. We really would. Not to be overlooked is the National Empowerment Television, or NET. It's a new cable network. It's available in all 50 states. It offers round-the-clock conservative political commentary nonstop. Newt Gingrich has a show. Hey, there's one you don't want to miss. In the words of its founder, Paul Weyrich, NET is dedicated to countering media news that is riddled with a far-left political bias and unacceptable notions about gender norming, racial quotas, global warming, and gays in the military. These are the mortal dangers that he's facing. I'll quote you David Bergen. David Bergen is editor-in-chief of the Oakland Tribune, out near where I live in the Bay Area, California now. And this is what Bergen says. And this is very interesting because this comes from an editor-in-chief of a mainstream newspaper. And he says, the greatest myth in America, or one of the top five at least, is the notion of the liberal press. That is such a crock. By the way, one thing about some newsmen is that you're impressed by their eloquence of phrasing. But that is such a crock. And the media bashing based on this so-called liberalness, Bergen goes on, that guys like Limbaugh get away with attacking. You know what? In all the years I've worked for newspapers, and the total is 18 or 19 of them, I have never worked for a liberal newspaper. Not one. There's only a half dozen in the entire country. There are some 1,700 daily newspapers, and they're all run by Republicans. Why? Because Republicans are the kind of people who own things. He left out a variable there. The rich are the kind of people who own things, and they tend to be Republican. That's why. And I don't know one of them who's going to let some liberal run his newsroom. It ain't going to happen. Well, who owns the big media, the mainstream media that reaches millions of people? The press lords who come to mind are right-wing conservatives or moderately right, maybe. William Randolph Hearst, Henry Luce, Rupert Murdoch, who describes himself not as a conservative but as a radical conservative, meaning a very extreme, tense conservative. Sulzberger, Annenberg, people of markedly conservative hue, who, by the way, leave their ideological imprint on the editorial news Sulzberger used to call up the editorials for the next morning that were going to go in the New York Times, and he would go into them. He's the publisher, right, and directly going in and interfering, and sometimes even on the front page. His son is taking over. Punch is, the old man is retired. The young one is even more conservative. He says he meets with his editorial board every day. Rupert Murdoch, who probably owns more media in the world than any other individual, owns almost all the media of Australia, was an Australian, came to the U.S., found there were restrictive laws against how much media a non-U.S. citizen can own, so he became a citizen within a month. Most people have to wait a number of years, you know, green card, residency, all that stuff. He got it like that, and owns enormous numbers of newspapers and TV stations. He was interviewed once. Interview was carried in Vanity Fair. The question was, you're considered to be politically conservative. To what extent do you influence the editorial posture of your newspapers? And I thought you'd get that usual blather about, well, of course, I respect the editorial integrity and independence and professionalism of my editors and blah, 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 blah. He didn't say anything like that. He responded with rather refreshing candor. He said, to what extent do I influence my editorial policies of my newspapers? Considerably. My editors have input, but I make the final decision. That's very refreshing, you know, when they come right out and they say what really happens. I do it, understand? You do what I say because I control your career, your job. And my control of your job and your salary gives me control of your mind, too. And if there's some kind of incongruity there and clash, then your mind goes out the door with your butt, you see. The boards of directors of print and broadcast news organizations are populated by representatives from Ford, General Motors, General Electric, General Dynamics, Dow Corning, Alcoa, Coca-Cola, Philip Morris, ITT, IBM, AT&T, and other corporations. So these boards are filled with the representatives of corporate America. That's your free and independent media. You see, the media in this country are not close to corporate America. They're not friendly to corporate America. They're not inclined or biased toward corporate America. They are corporate America. They are multinational giant corporations, and their boards are inhabited with the same people who inhabit the boards, these interlocking directorates who inhabit the boards of all the other giant corporations and come from these other corporations. Among the major stockholders of the three largest broadcast networks are Chase Manhattan, J.P. Morgan, and Citibank. NBC is owned by General Electric. CBS is owned by Tisch. ABC, Capital Cities, is owned by Disney. GE and Disney are the two most conservative corporations that exist. Fox Network is owned by Rupert Murdoch. What's the free, independent media we're talking about? And these people appoint the presidents of the corporations, who appoint the bureau chiefs, who appoint the top editors, who appoint the reporters. If you look at the organization of any news organization, it looks like the army, top-down command right down along the way. And their profits are as high as anything in corporate America, and the degree of merger and concentration is higher than it is in finance capital and in manufacturing capital. Media are highly profitable, highly concentrated. Given that distribution of ownership, it's not surprising that labor is regularly downplayed, the concerns of labor. In this last election, for instance, you remember the AFL-CIO said, we're going to get political, we're going to go out there, and we are pledging, the story got around all the media, $35 million we will spend in the campaign. And suddenly the terms were being revised. Big labor is influencing, flexing its muscles in the campaign. They're going to spend $35 million. You could not have missed it. It turned out they spent about $25 million. But it was all over the media about big labor. Let me tell you something, folks, that in the state of California and in the state of Florida, there were corporations that spent $40, $50, $60 million in California to defeat a single-payer health program for the citizens of the state of California, in Florida to defeat protection of the wetlands and environmental laws. They spent more money to defeat little state propositions on the ballot in those states for a few propositions than labor spent in all over the country. But you wouldn't have known it. There were no big headlines about big capital. You heard about big labor? Did you hear about big capital spending 10 times more than anybody else? For both parties, buying politicians of all stripes and wedding them to their way? The concerns of labor are your concerns. They're the concerns of ordinary working people. They're the concerns about wages. They're the concerns about work conditions. They're the concerns about job opportunities. The concerns about consumer safety, occupational safety, environmental protection. Those are the things that labor unions, especially the more progressive labor unions, have been fighting for and talking about for years. You wouldn't know it. It's not in the business-owned media. You've got a business section. Go buy a newspaper tomorrow and pick up that newspaper. You'll find a business section for that 2, 3, 4% that own about 80% of the capital in America. Where's the labor section? Where's the labor news? Where are the concerns of working people? Jonathan Tassini, head of the National Writers Union, my union, I'm a member of it. I'm a writer, I thought I'd unionize, why not? I believe in it. He studied all reports dealing with workers' issues carried by ABC, CBS, NBC, Evening Television News, during one whole year. And he defined labor issues rather widely. It included a few consumer issues and child care issues. It came to only 2.3% of total coverage. We're not even talking about how they were covered, just that there was even any mention. 2.3% of the total news coverage was for labor's issues. For that 120 million people who work for a living, 140 million, whatever it is now. No wonder another survey found that only 6% of business leaders in America thought that media treatment accorded them was poor, while 66% said it was good or excellent. Another influence on the media, a conservative influence, are the corporate advertisers. They exercise a considerable influence. Todd Gitlin interviewed these network bosses and said, to what extent was entertainment TV? So to what extent do your advertisers influence your decisions regarding what you put in your programs? And again, I thought you'd hear the usual blather of, well, it can be a pressure occasionally, but that's the exception. We have our individual standards and all that. Every one of them said, all the time. To what extent? We always keep them guys. Are you kidding? Those are our accounts. Are you kidding? They pay the bills all the time. You bet you. We watch out all the time as to what bothers them or doesn't bother them. In fact, a lot of our programming isn't for you. It is to please our advertiser. It's not to please the public, necessarily. And often the advertiser does come in and threatens and cancels accounts, not generally because their product is being poorly reflected, but more often because they perceive that there are liberal tendencies creeping into news reports and commentaries or into the particular shows, whatever else. Religious media manifests the same imbalance. How many of us have heard of the Christian Right? I bet everybody has. They have a whole network, the Christian Broadcasting Network, CBN, Pat Robertson. They have several $1 billion worth of media. They have hundreds of radio stations. 10% of all radio outlets in America are controlled by the Christian right-wingers. 14% of the nation's television stations are owned and controlled by the Christian right-wingers. Have you ever heard of a Christian left? There happens to be a very substantial Christian left in America. Liberation theology, people who believe in progressive reform, people who believe that the word of Christ means the social gospel, that you live Christ out in the street, that you find and you work with other people in need and you work for social justice. Where are they? They don't own any networks. That's right, because big money doesn't back a Christian right. They consider them communist, a Christian left, I'm sorry. They consider a Christian left communistic. Big money backs the Christian right and gets them out there in the media. And those are the people who are heard. Those are the people who get the subscriptions. Those are the people who then rally the souls. A favorite conservative hallucination is that the public broadcasting system, PBS, is a leftist stronghold. There are a few occasionally good documentaries on PBS, although two of the very best that I can recall, which won Academy Awards, Deadly Deception and Panama Deception, both won Academy Awards for full-length documentary features, have never appeared on PBS except one or two local stations. In fact, more than 70% of PBS's primetime shows are funded either completely or in major part by four giant oil companies. No wonder we often refer to PBS as standing for Petroleum Broadcasting System. PBS public affairs programs are underwritten. Remember, you know when they say our underwriters? You watch PBS, don't you, occasionally? You know? Our underwriters are. This is such a genteel term. They mean advertisers. Our filthy rich corporate advertisers are. They don't want to come right out and say that. Are General Electric, General Motors, Metropolitan Life, PepsiCo, Mobil, Payne Weber, Exxon, and the like. A study of these shows by one media watchdog group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, found that corporate representatives constituted 44% of the sources about the economy. Public interest advocates accounted for 3%, while labor representatives were virtually shut out and non-existent. Another thing is the appearance of false diversity, I would call it. I think I call it, in Inventing Reality, I call it false balancing. You can watch a talk show or a panel, and there'll be two, three, four people. You watch Nightline, he says, we have so-and-so from here, we have so-and-so from there, and they'll get into arguments with each other, and you can sit there, and you are being reassured, you see, there is openness and diversity in our media, difference of opinion. I heard a debate one time on the David Brinkley show. It was between, one of them was Elliot Abrams, and I forget who the other guy was. No, Abrams was in the State Department. He was in the Pentagon, so it wasn't Abrams. It was that guy named Perez, and I forget the other fellow's name. One of them was arguing that the escalated level of defense spending under the Reagan administration, up to $300 billion, almost $300 billion a year, was sufficient, and the escalation was a good thing. The other one was arguing that the escalation was a good thing, but we should escalate even more and spend still more in defense spending. So those were the two sides of the argument. And it reminds you that, you know, when you hear two sides of an argument, you're not hearing all sides of an argument. And so again, you see that whole other part of the spectrum, that whole public interest, progressive left part, has been amputated and thrown out of the picture. Crossfire is a very good example. Michael Kinsley against Pat Buchanan. And Michael Kinsley had a moment of truth. He said something that was very, very true. He said as follows. If you watch Crossfire, they say, on the left, Michael Kinsley. On the right, Pat Buchanan. They have new people now, I know. I try not to watch that show. I've been on it twice. It's a screaming feast, you know. You sit there and you got one conservative here screaming, you got the other one here screaming, and the left that day was Tom Brandon, who really looked almost like he was giving up the ghost. They just sit there and, well, I don't know, gee. And the right was Robert Novak. And I finally turned to Robert Novak. I said, are you going to let me finish the sentence, or is this a screaming match? He said, you'll finish a sentence, but first we have to cut for commercial. You know? And this is the way it is. And try to develop a thought is impossible. So you just scream, no, that's not true. Yes, it is. No, it is. And that sort of thing. This is what passes for discourse, for the universe of political discourse in a democratic citizenry. We're supposed to be informed and make up our minds about certain things looking at this kind of thing. Did I tell you what Kinsley said? Or I forgot. You're not the only one getting old. We're all getting old. Kinsley made this point. He said, Buchanan is much further to the right than I am to the left. And that's exactly the point, you see, that what passes for the liberal or left opinion is really a skittish, very nervous, centrist position that's constantly dressing up its right, that's constantly worrying that it might not be seen as too far out here, which is not the right. The right goes as far right as it wants to go. So then even what passes for liberal opinion in the media must take place within a conservative framework. Not surprisingly, then, public discussion is heavily skewed to the right. On foreign affairs, the media's role as cheerleader of the national security state and free market capitalism is without restraint. Virtually no positive exposure has ever been given to an indigenous third world revolutionary or reformist struggles, or to protests at home and abroad against U.S. overseas interventions. U.S. military undertakings in the Vietnam War, the invasion of Grenada and Panama, the Reagan intervention against Nicaragua, the Gulf War massacre. All these undertakings are portrayed as arising from noble, if sometimes perhaps misplaced, intentions. The whole critique, the whole debate during the Vietnam War, I remember, was between those people who said we could win the war and those people who said we could win the war. See, now the assumption of the second was if we could, there'd be no argument then, you see. But there wasn't all of us, the millions of us who were out in the streets getting beaten up by the police, getting arrested and all other things, including me, the millions of us who said there shouldn't be a war, whether you could win it or lose it. And the horror of it was that you might even win it. That war was immoral. It was homicidal. It was killing hundreds of thousands of people. We now see 2 million Vietnamese died in that war. The United States killed 2 million Vietnamese. The Nazis killed, you know, millions of people. We see that as a horrible thing. This was seen in our media as well-intentioned struggle, but it went awry. The Vietnamese weren't ready for democracy, it seems. We tried to bring them democracy with those B-52s and napalm and rapid fire deployment forces and free fire zones and all that. But the damn fool people just didn't want to come to their senses. You've all heard about Bosnia, haven't you? Who hasn't heard about Bosnia? Raise your hand. Ah, see? Right back there. You could leave. Okay. How many has heard about Mozambique? You've heard about people dying in Bosnia. You've heard about people dying in Rwanda. Well, in Mozambique, there was something like 1 million people died. In Angola, there was something like 3 million in wars that were being fought, financed by the CIA. Not a word about it. The massive killings and slaughters that went on by mercenary forces throughout the country, the atrocities, unspeakable stuff, it went on for years. Within a six-month period, 600,000 people killed in Angola. Not a word about it, because the media didn't talk about it. So you see, they may not predetermine what you think, but what they do is they can prefigure what we think about. We talk about those things, maybe not exactly the way they might want us, but they seem to set the agenda for what we believe is important. And when you ask about all these other issues, they'll say, well, look, you know, we have a limited amount of time and space. We just can't cover everything. We have to be very selective and careful, and we've got to compress and condense things. Isn't that right? Haven't you noticed that selective, compressed, and condensed story just recently about the Heavenly Gate cult? Right? Wasn't that compressed and condensed? It was only about a week of 24 hours a day. We had interviews of relatives, of friends who knew somebody who had been close to someone else who was in the cult. Interviews of stock boys who worked in stores where cult members had shopped in, they think, you know. Right? I mean, really, this is the media that doesn't have enough time to cover everything. And they went on and on and on about these things. Meanwhile, not a word about Mozambique.
Michael Parenti at the University of Vermont in April 1997. He's speaking on the hidden ideology of the news media. Please come back next week for part two of this fine lecture. And even if you don't, I thank you for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. My name is Kenneth Doust. My advice is as follows. Illegitimate non-carborundum. Question authority. Save water. Shower with a friend. There's another old one. And please come back again next week. Ciao.
This is Jeff Blankford. On this past December 28th, when street protests broke out across Iran and seized the attention of the White House, Congress, and the U.S. media, by the purest of coincidences, an Israeli television station broke the news that a secret agreement had been negotiated in Washington 2 weeks earlier between the U.S. and Israel to challenge Iran and its actions across the Middle East. As reported by the Times of Israel, citing a special report on Israel's Channel 10, Israel and the United States secretly signed a far-reaching joint memorandum of understanding providing for full cooperation to deal with Iran, quote, Iran's nuclear drive, its missile programs, and its other threatening activities, end quote. This report was confirmed in Washington and reported in the Israeli press, including its English-language editions, but the only mention it merited at the time or since in the U.S. media was on this program and the relatively obscure online journal Business Insider. The document was signed on December 12th at the White House, quote, culminating intensive talks between representatives of the major Israeli and American intelligence and military hierarchies, headed by the U.S. and Israeli National Security Advisors H.R. McMaster and Maida Ben-Shabat. Citing both American and Israeli officials, the Times of Israel said the document is designed to translate into, quote, steps on the ground, the position set out by U.S. President Donald Trump in his October 13 speech on Iran, in which he renewed his attacks on the agreement that the Obama administration had made with Iran and with members of the U.N. Security Council in Germany to reduce and curtail Iran's nuclear enrichment program. Citing both American and Israeli officials, the Times of Israel story said the document is designed to translate into, quote, steps on the ground, the position set out by U.S. President Donald Trump in his October speech. The fact that the U.S. media has suppressed this story may be as significant as the subject of the story itself, and I was hoping to be speaking with Grant Smith, the director of IRMEP, the Washington-based Institute for Research Middle East Policy. We're having some trouble with our phones and hope that we get Grant on the air. On March 2nd, Smith's Institute and the Washington Report on the Middle East Affairs will be co-hosting a conference of the National Press Club in Washington on the Israel lobby and American policy, which will feature an outstanding array of speakers that, like the secret agreement with Israel regarding Iran, is sure to get no coverage from the U.S. media. The evidence is more than conclusive. News and information that might reflect badly on Israel, the U.S. media will keep hidden from the American public. A notorious example that I've mentioned on Takes on the World in the past is the media's collective failure to report on the fabulously successful fundraising dinners held each year in Beverly Hills and New York for the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces. These dinners, held at the Beverly Hills Hilton and the Waldorf Astoria, feature top entertainers and well-known Hollywood stars and raise tens of millions of tax-exempt dollars from wealthy American Jews to promote the welfare of the Israel Defense Forces, a foreign army. The news that on each successive year, these dinners raise record-breaking amounts of money for the Israeli army, while tens of thousands of U.S. veterans are homeless in America's streets, would not go down well with a significant segment of Americans, and as such, it's obviously better from the Israeli perspective that they don't know about it. In November of last year, the dinner in Beverly Hills raised $53.8 million in a matter of a few hours, with the Oracle's Larry Ellison providing $16.6 million of that record number. That dinner and all the others in Beverly Hills are hosted by Israeli-American billionaire Haim Saban and his wife Cheryl, two of the biggest donors to the Democratic Party, and in particular to Bill and more recently Hillary Clinton. The Sabans, of course, can be counted on to kick in a few million dollars at each year's dinner for their favorite army. If you think the success of these dinners would merit a story or at least a headline somewhere besides in the Variety, Hollywood's trade organ, you'd be correct, but unaware of whose thumb is on the nation's media. The secret deal between the White House and Israel regarding Iran has far more sinister implications, however, than fundraisers by phony charities. According to the TV report and the Times of Israel, the two countries agreed to set up joint teams to handle various aspects of what was described as, quote, the Iranian threat. One such team, the report said, will deal with Iranian activity in Syria and Tehran's support for Hezbollah, which it described as, quote, a terrorist organization. Another joint team will deal with both diplomatic and intelligence activities designed to grapple, that's the Times of Israel's word, grapple, with Iran's nuclear weapons ambitions, despite the International Atomic Energy's conclusion that Iran is abiding by the terms of the nuclear deal and is making no effort to construct a nuclear weapon. A third joint team, it was reportedly agreed, would grapple with Iran's ballistic missile program and its efforts to build accurate missile systems in Syria and Lebanon. Finally, a fourth team would oversee preparation for any escalation by Iran and Hezbollah. McMaster and Ben Shabbat signed the joint agreement, the TV report said, quoting a, quote, senior U.S. government source and senior Israeli officials, end quote. Quoting Israeli officials, Channel 10 said, the meeting confirmed that the U.S. and Israel, quote, see eye to eye on the trends and processes in the region, end quote, and have now reached an agreement on the strategy and policy required to deal with them. With all due respect to President Trump's declaration on Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, Channel 10 reporter Barak Ravid predicted the December 12th, quote, dramatic understandings, end quote, would have a, quote, far greater impact on the security of Israel's citizens, end quote. About the rest of the world, he didn't say. Whether it had anything to do with Israel shooting down an Israeli Iranian drone over the weekend, which resulted in the Syrians downing an Israeli F-16, something they had not been able to do since 1982, remains to be seen. In Israel, quote, the downed F-16 prompted widespread hand-wringing and discussions about whether or not the Jewish state still maintains air superiority in the region, wrote the Times of Israel's Judah Ari Gross. So first, let's be clear, it doesn't, according to Gross. Israel, he wrote, hasn't had true air superiority in the region since late 2015, when Russia decided to install an S-400 missile defense battery in Syria, powerful enough to track the vast majority of Israeli airspace. Since then, Israel has effectively been operating in Syria by the grace of Moscow. A fly can't buzz above Syria without Russians' consent nowadays, an Israeli military official told the International Crisis Group think tank after the S-400 was installed. Still, wrote Gross, Israeli officials insist that the military is prepared to act with or without Russia's tacit approval, end quote. The F-16, a gift from Congress and U.S. taxpayers, was shot down on Saturday morning after it and seven other Israeli fighter jets took part in an airstrike on a military base near Palmyra in central Syria, from which the Israelis claim an Iranian operator flew an Iranian drone into Israeli territory an hour earlier. The downing of the F-16 might have ended a false notion of the Israeli forces' invincibility, but it does not have serious negative consequences for Israel's aerial dominance, Israeli experts say. Far more serious is the potential for Russia to end the policy it has maintained until now of not taking direct action against Israeli planes conducting airstrikes against targets in Syria. Quote, it does not appear to be the result of any kind of new Syria capability or unknown Israeli vulnerability, but some combination of human error, lucky timing, and perhaps a degree of hubris by the flight team, Brigadier General Amon Eindar, head of the Israeli Air Force's Training and Doctrine Division, told the Idiot Aranat news site. There's no new issue that we hadn't previously identified. We operate in Syria continuously, conducting thousands of missions in Syria in just the last year, said the general, referring both to airstrikes and far more common reconnaissance operations. Well, a very different viewpoint was expressed by Haaretz columnist Gideon Levy, Israel's most well-known dissident journalist. He says, quote, Israeli arrogance might not have ended Saturday, but it surely cracked. Suddenly, wrote Levy, it became clear that Israel is not alone in the Middle Eastern skies, that even its immense military power has its limits. There could be a silver lining, he writes, if Israel accepts that it cannot forever live by the sword, not even by advanced airplanes. Perhaps the F-16 that was downed took down with it the doctrine according to which everything can and should be resolved by force. First of all, force. Always force. Only force. Decades of air supremacy. And as often as in Lebanon and the Gaza Strip, air exclusivity, writes Levy, have led Israel to behave as if it is not the only the strongest power in the skies of the Middle East, but the only one. On Saturday, this assumption reached its end, wrote Levy. Israel is not alone in the sky, and the price is painful. The comic relief was when Israel claimed the Iranian drone had violated its sovereignty. Israel can violate anyone's sovereignty, wrote Levy. Overflowing Lebanon, bombing in Syria, Sudan, and, of course, helpless Gaza. But only the Iranian drone violated sovereignty, end quote. Well, that was from Gideon Levy writing in Haaretz, who will be among the speakers at that conference in Washington on the Israel lobby and American policy at the National Press Club on March 2nd. More about that later. Meanwhile, complicating the situation and not unlikely raising the threat of a wider war and an Israeli military strike, the Israeli police yesterday recommended that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu be indicted on bribery and breach of trust charges in two alleged corruption cases. The recommendation, made public on Tuesday evening, comes after year-long investigations into the two alleged corruption cases. State prosecutors must now decide whether or not to file indictments. Netanyahu, in an address to the nation Tuesday, maintained his innocence, saying the recommendations, quote, cast a dark shadow, end quote, and have no place in a democratic state, end quote. I will keep working for the good of the country, not for cigars from a friend, and not for better media coverage, he said, responding to the accusations. The latter is a reference to a recorded conversation between Netanyahu and the publisher of Yedid Ahronot, Israel's best-selling newspaper, in which the publisher was told that if he ran stories favorable to the prime minister, he would see to it that his paper would get less competition from Israel Hayom, a free national newspaper with a wider circulation. And that paper is owned by Netanyahu's close friend and supporter, the American Jewish billionaire, casino owner Sheldon Adelson, who, it should be remembered, donated $25 million to the campaign of Donald Trump. The Israeli prime minister said he is sure he'll be reelected in the next national elections, which are scheduled for November 2019. As the situation in Syria heats up among all the players, including Israel, the United States so far have limited their exchanges to a war of words. However, signs aren't encouraging that it will end there, notes Al-Monitor's Metin Gürkan. Quote from Gürkan, decision makers in Ankara have toughened their rhetoric against the United States, and many senior figures in the ruling Justice and Development Party, AKP, are hinting at the possibility of armed confrontation between Turkish and U.S. soldiers. If the U.S. soldiers wear the garb of terrorists and hang around with them, and if they attack Turkish soldiers, no doubt we will not have a chance to distinguish between them, Deputy Prime Minister Bekir Bozdak said last week. In a February 6th speech before AKP parliamentarians, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said, speaking to the United States, get out of Manbij. We will come there to deliver the land to its true owners, end quote. Turkey started its assault on Afrin in northern Syria, to drive out the Kurds, specifically the People's Protection Unit called the YPG. Ankara appears insistent on expanding the Afrin offensive in Minbij, about 60 miles east, after gaining full control of the area west of the Euphrates River. The United States, for its part, points out Gürkan, sounds determined not to abandon Minbij, even though it has no permanent military outposts there. As Ankara hardened its stance, he reported, a coalition including Lieutenant General Paul Funk and Major General James Jarrett of the U.S. Army visited Manbij on February 7th and had plenty to say. Quote, we're very proud of our positions there, here, and we want to make sure everyone knows it, said Gerard, the Special Operations Commander for the U.S.-led coalition against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. You hit us, we will respond aggressively. We will defend ourselves, Funk added, raising the stakes. An armed confrontation February 7th between U.S.-backed democratic forces and President Bashar al-Assad's forces backed by Russia escalated to a major battle in Deir ez-Zor, an oil-rich town eastern Syria. U.S. warplanes were involved, and a number of Russian paramilitary private contractors were reportedly killed, although the Russians deny it. Yet another sign the U.S. intends to hold on to the territory it has brought under its control in the post-ISIS setting. Is an armed confrontation in Manbij between Turkish and U.S. soldiers representing the two largest armies in NATO really a possibility? Well, the key consideration here, observes our monitors, Metin Gürkan, is whether Turkey is genuinely willing to challenge the United States militarily in Syria. Or, he asks, is Ankara's increasingly aggressive rhetoric just part of its effort to deter the U.S. military from working more closely with the Kurdish YPG in Manbij? Of course, nobody seems ready to ask the question, by what right does the United States have to have any troops at all in Syria? Well, since last year's elections, there's been increasing conversation about how these times bring to mind the novel 1984 by the British writer George Orwell, first published in 1949 in response to the rise of totalitarian societies in the wake of World War II. Last Thursday, I attended the opening of an extraordinarily powerful adaptation of Orwell's novel at the Ukiah Players Theater, directed by Chris Douthat, with an outstanding cast of local performers. It was a sobering experience that pulled no punches, and one that I recommend to all of you in the sound of my voice. Performances of 1984 are scheduled on Friday and Saturday nights, with Sunday matinees through the 4th of March at the Ukiah Players Theater on Low Gap Road across from Ukiah High School. I really recommend it. I was unable to connect Grant Smith to the board, so I went on with the program. He could hear me, so rather than an interview with Grant Smith at this point in time, I'm going to read an article that he posted today about the subject of censorship on the part of the Israel lobby. So I'm going to tell him that, and we will move on with the program. And the headline is a story, Will Al Jazeera Air the Lobby Before AIPAC Meets? AIPAC is going to the largest U.S. lobby in terms of foreign lobby that doesn't register as a foreign agent is going to have its annual conference next month in Washington, at which two-thirds of the members of Congress are supposed to be among the 20,000 attending that conference, including major speakers, including Benjamin Netanyahu, but also the leaders of the U.S. Senate from both political parties, because support for Israel is a bipartisan affair, but also the editor of Breitbart News will be a featured speaker because AIPAC is moving in that direction as the country or the leadership in Washington has moved in that direction. At that AIPAC conference, the members who attend have their names read off one by one. So those who have money to support America's by America's politicians, unique in America, will be able to know who to send money to when the election rolls around later in the year. But here is the article that Grant Smith has written today for be posted on the Internet. The Israel lobby, writes Grant, has a lot of levers it can push and pull to curry favorable news coverage from media organizations. These range from denying access to the limited pool of top-tier pundits and Israeli government officials to crippling economic boycotts. This power is visible in the battle to punish and shutter Al Jazeera, the Qatar-based state-funded news organization. Al Jazeera's undercover investigated series, The Lobby, stunned both UK and US viewers last year. The project of a six-month 2016 undercover investigation, the four-part series revealed the Israeli embassy's close guidance of allegedly, quote, independent pro-Israel UK domestic organizations, unfounded accusations of anti-Semitism lodged against Labour Party members, and coordinated efforts to take down lawmakers deemed hostile to Israel. The series led to the dismissal of Shai Mossat, a shadowy Israeli embassy official profiled in part four of the series, and apologies from the Israeli embassy. Less well known, Grant Smith goes on, is that concurrent to the UK investigation, another undercover reporter was hard at work penetrating Israel's Washington lobby, James Anthony Kleinfeld, a British citizen interned at the Israel Project. The Israel Project works as a quasi-public relations agency for Israel, using its cartel-like access to sought-after Israeli officials to shape media appearances and influence who can appear opposite Israel's media luminaries. The behind-the-scenes activity of the Israel Project's chief, former Israeli American-Israel Public Affairs Committee spokesperson Josh Block, to condition and ultimately quash the appearance of Rula Jibril, a Palestinian, on Voice of America, were exposed via a Freedom of Information Act request in 2016. Kleinfeld reportedly gained access to the Israel Project's donor information by asking to work in donor development, a position not normally given to interns. Not much is known about the source of that nonprofit 501c3, the Israel's Project funding. That, by the way, is a charity. Imagine that, a charity, right? The Israel Project's funding. Under the leadership of founder Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi, donations grew from $1.8 million in 2003 and peaked at nearly $20 million in 2010. Donations fell to $8.7 million in 2016 after the Israel Project received stinging rebukes from more established Israel lobbying organizations over its claims to be a one-stop shop leading all major branches of Israel advocacy. The Internal Revenue Service claims it cannot locate any of the publicly releasable PDF documents the Israel Project presented in its application for tax-exempt status for social welfare purpose it allegedly serves. Almost immediately, Grant Smith writes, following the airing of the lobby, as in Britain, the government of Qatar, which owns Al Jazeera, suddenly faced an intense coordinated campaign accusing it of supporting terrorism, being too close to Iran, and demanding that Al Jazeera be shut down. The quote-unquote Qatar diplomatic crisis is not easily traceable directly back to Israel or the lobby's intense displeasure over the UK investigative report or to fears that the U.S. edition would be released. The countries that first cut off diplomatic relations with Qatar were Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt. However, the Qatari government soon came to its own conclusion that exiting the crisis demanded wooing the Western pro-Israel lobby. The Emirates sent a series of invitations to Mort Klein, head of the Zionist Organization of America, one of the oldest Israel advocacy organizations in the U.S., to visit the Emirate beginning in September of 2017. Klein lobbied the Obama administration to cancel Qatar Airways landing rights in the United States to escalate the crisis. The airline last reported annual revenue was $10.6 billion, and with $538 million in profits and 43,000 employees. Other Israel advocates such as Alan Dershowitz visited the Emirates along with leaders of the American Jewish Congress and Conference of Presidents of major American Jewish organizations. Many demanded that Qatar cut ties to Hamas, the Taliban, and Iran, but this may have been cover for their principal aim to shutter Al Jazeera and keep the U.S. series from airing. Work is currently underway to convince the Department of Justice to order Al Jazeera to register as a foreign agent, limiting its access to facilities and U.S. government officials. Such activities have generated back-page stories claiming that Al Jazeera finally promised the wave of Israel lobbyists it would not air the now somewhat aging The Lobby U.S. edition. The most sensible time to release it would be just before AIPAC convenes in Washington in early March. But many in the pro-Israel ecosystem grew alarmed, writes Grant Smith, when Al Jazeera sent letters requesting comments on its U.S. investigative series to Israel lobby organizations in early February. Such letters are commonplace before big investigative pieces air. Qatari Foreign Minister Sheikh Mohammed Al Thani claimed Qatar's constitution forbids any interference in the media. Whether Al Jazeera finally broadcast the U.S. series of The Lobby before AIPAC convenes will reveal whether it remains true to its upstart, quote, take no prisoners reporting, or has become as beholden to orchestrated Israel lobby pressure campaigns, as mainstream U.S. media organizations, and as fellow government-owned outlets like the Voice of America. That's Grant Smith on this same subject of the Israel lobby broadcast on Al Jazeera and the Jewish publication Tablet today. Article called Qatar and American Jews, News About Inflammatory Documentary Breaks Just As a Charm Offensive Is Underway. What does Doha, that's Qatar's capital, really want? By Armin Rosen, he writes, quote, on February 2nd, Philip Rees, a Doha-based manager of investigations at Al Jazeera, who I've actually interviewed once, sent letters to several U.S.-based Jewish and pro-Israel organizations, along with various current and former employees of those organizations, informing them that they will likely be featured in a documentary, quote, concerning the role of pro-Israel advocacy groups in the United States, end quote. Qatar-based Al Jazeera is a subsidiary of the regime-owned Qatar Media Corporation. The February 2nd letters confirm that an agent of the network had secretly recorded pro-Israel activists, end quote. As one letter recipient explained, the vast majority of people in Washington hold insignificant jobs in insignificant organizations. Quote, no one ever walks into these places and says, tell me how important you are. Little surprised that a charming and seemingly earnest British-accented 23-year-old polyglot was able to get other 23-year-olds to exaggerate about their organization's activities or explain how they thought things really worked in the pro-Israel world, end quote. If the documentary runs, it is an absolute certainty that there will be some kind of effort in Congress and the pro-Israel community to make Al Jazeera register under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, FARA. This past week, New Jersey Congressman Josh Gottheimer, happens to be Jewish, began circulating a letter that called on the Justice Department to explore the issue further, citing, quote, Al Jazeera's record of radical anti-American, anti-Semitic, and anti-Israel broadcasts. Now, that's called chutzpah, because none of these Israeli advocacy organizations have registered or have been asked to register since 1963 as agents of what they are of the Israeli government. And they're able to get away with registering as 501c3 charities, which means anyone giving money to them, those donations are tax exempt. So you give money to the Israel Project and is tax exempt. Now, AIPAC is a 501c4, which means your donations to them are not tax exempt, but Israel, but the AIPAC pays no taxes. So if you want to talk about occupied territory, and I talk about Washington being occupied territory, it is Israel's most important occupied territory. And the idea that because Al Jazeera is exposing the Israel lobby for what it is, they will have to register their foreign agent, just like RT has had to register the foreign agent because they don't go along with the neocons' line of thinking about Israel, Russia, and the Middle East. I should mention that it's not widely known, but President John Kennedy challenged Israel in several different ways. One, he was the first and last president to support the right of return for Palestinians to their homeland. At that time, there were 700,000 approximately, and he said at least 100,000 would have to go back. This is a red line Israel could not afford to have happen. Secondly, he adamantly opposed Israel's nuclear weapons program and was furious at Ben-Gurion setting up what they call Potemkin villages, phony laboratories to make it appear that Israel's nuclear program was peaceful. It wasn't. But finally, maybe the most important thing that Israel objected to was Kennedy's request of the Justice Department under his brother Bobby to force the American Zionist Council, which was the father or the predecessor to AIPAC. It's more complicated than that, but I'll explain in a moment, to register as a foreign agent in 1962. And in 1963, Senator William Fulbright, very famous senator for whom the Fulbright scholarships were named, held hearings that you never hear about But Grant Smith has written about it. He's the only person to write about them. Held hearings in which it turned out that money donated to Israel by Jewish Americans and by others who support Israel was being funneled back to the United States to buy propaganda in the United States promoting Israel. And this basis was one of the bases for calling on the American Zionist Council, which was run by an Israeli citizen, Canadian-born Israeli, actually, who registered as a foreign agent, Cy Kennan, to register as a foreign agent. And during 63, after these hearings, the Justice Department lawyers tried to get the American Zionist Council to do that. And the American Zionist Council's lawyers obfuscated and obfuscated until that day on November 22nd, 1963. Kennedy was taken out, taken from us. And Lyndon Johnson, who was a great friend of Israel, the greatest up to that point, did not pursue the case, and his Justice Department replacement for Bobby Kennedy, Nicholas Katzenbach, did not push it, and no American president has made any effort to get the Israel lobby, any organization in the Israel lobby, to register as a foreign agent. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting KZOX.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. On the Ground to Israel, with Jeff Halper, anthropologist and activist, coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, and author of The War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification. And Jeff, it's very good to have you back.
It's very good to be back.
Jeff, you wrote an article recently which follows the announcement by President Trump of moving the U.S. embassy to and recognizing the capital of the Jewish state, as they posit it, to be Jerusalem. Your article was, "The two-state solution only ever meant a big Israel rolling over a Palestinian Bantustan. Let it go." Why don't you first take us to your position, or how the progressive Israeli community has looked at the recent pronouncements of Trump and indeed the visit just of Vice President Pence.
Well, you know, I mean, all these years since 1967, pretty much, the Israeli peace camp, progressive Israelis, together with our Palestinian partners, have advocated for a two-state solution. The idea of a Palestinian state alongside the state of Israel, even though the Palestinian state would only be on 22% of historic Palestine. Nevertheless, in 1988, the PLO under Arafat accepted that solution. It's not fair and it's not just, but the Palestinians accepted it. And that's what we were working for many years. It became clear way before Trump, probably when the Oslo process collapsed almost 20 years ago, that the two-state solution was gone. As a matter of fact, when Netanyahu was elected the first time in 1996, it was clear that the two-state solution was gone and that the occupation was going to reassert itself in a very strong way. But, you know, it's very hard. It's not a scientific, you know, when did it exactly end, or what is the red line, or how do you know definitely the two-state solution is not going to be relevant anymore? That's a hard thing to call. And it's been a process of people gradually understanding that the two-state solution is gone. We understood that years ago, but for many people, it's very threatening, that idea, because especially for Jews and for most Israelis, of course, if the two-state solution is gone, it means either we have apartheid, because we have an Israel that controls the entire country, including all the land and 4.5 million Palestinians, and it can't give them citizenship, so it would be apartheid, or a binational state in which it can't be a Jewish state anymore, whatever that meant. Israelis are caught because on the one hand, they know the two-state solution is gone, and they really don't care, because the Palestinians are easy to control from the Israeli point of view. But at the same time, they can't give up the two-state solution, or at least lip service to it, because that would open the way either to apartheid or binationalism. So we're caught in a situation where we're living in an illusion. The American government, all the governments of the world, progressive Jews like J Street, for example, even progressive Israelis, the Zionist left, Meretz and the Labor Party, even the Arab List, even the Palestinian Authority, are all still talking about the two-state solution, because you avoid the crunch as long as you keep this going. And at the same time, you know, then Israel really can continue to rule, do whatever it wants to do, build settlements, control the country without ever having to really make an agreement with the Palestinians. I think Trump's contribution to all of this, when he declared Jerusalem the capital of Israel, actually there was a very good headline in Haaretz newspaper that said Trump didn't kill the two-state solution. You know, that was killed years ago, but he buried it. Once you take Jerusalem off the table, as the way Trump puts it, you defeat the two-state solution, because there can't possibly be a two-state solution without at least a shared Jerusalem as a Palestinian capital. And besides everything else, the settlements fragment the West Bank. There is no more place for a Palestinian state. So what Trump sort of did that's helpful, if you want to put it that way, is he cleared the air. Now I think we all have to move on from the two-state solution. The question is, where do we go? And that's where we're trying to work. A number of us, Palestinians and Israelis, are trying to really flesh out the idea of a common vision of a one democratic state solution. You know, you can't be in a political struggle without an end game. And our problem is, we know the two-state solution is gone, but we, progressive Israelis and our Palestinian partners, have not suggested an alternative. So there's a vacuum here. You know, Trump and Netanyahu can do whatever they want to do because there's no pushback. Because we don't have an agreed-upon progressive solution, political settlement of our own. And that's what we're working on, and we're going to have a meeting in the next couple of weeks to try to finalize that kind of a statement.
And where do you see that going, and how do you see that develop? If we accept the premise of one-state solution, which, again, you say really means Israeli-sanctioned apartheid, or, as you put it in your article, eternal bloody civil war. Where does that lead, and what kind of a group is actually cohering around the, what would it be, the overthrow of the conceptual framework, which seems enormously difficult, of quote-unquote a Jewish state? I mean, how do you see that unfolding?
It's going to be difficult, although we all did it with apartheid South Africa. That was unthinkable in its day as well, that apartheid would end. So there's two things, first of all, that are important to understand. One is that there already exists one state here. This whole idea of should there be two states or one state is a done deal. Between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, the entire country of Israel, Palestine, the occupied territories, is all today one functional state. There's only one government, the Israeli government, that controls everything, not the Palestinian Authority. That's really a meaningless kind of a thing. There's only one army, obviously, in the whole country. There's only one set of borders. There's only one currency. And in other words, by any measure, there already is one country, but it's an apartheid country. First of all, we have to say there is already one state, but it's in an unacceptable form, and that is apartheid. The other thing we have to say is that if this is Israel's doing. We can't blame the Palestinians for this. Israel knew what it was doing over the last half century deliberately and systematically, Israel eliminated the two-state solution by building settlements, by annexing good parts of the West Bank, and really by almost formally not negotiating any kind of a political solution. So if there's one state today, which means then there cannot be a Jewish state called Israel, it's Israel's doing. And that's something that I think we have to really emphasize. You can't control the entire country and control all the Palestinians and still want a Jewish state. It just doesn't work. So you have apartheid. So then the question becomes a little less difficult. If there already is one state here, an apartheid regime, then the task in front of us is, how do we transform that single state that already exists into a democratic state of equal rights for all its citizens? Which should not be such a revolutionary kind of an idea for Americans. All right, well, here's some Palestinians that are saying, all right, we'll buy some of your freedom and democracy. What are you going to say, no? So that I think you can put Israel in a really an untenable position by calling it on its apartheid, but in a positive way by suggesting a way out. And that way out is, let's have one state here, what we really have already, a binational state that protects the collective rights and identities of both peoples. You know, you can still be an Israeli. You can still speak Hebrew. You can still have a Hebrew university. But you're doing that alongside Palestinians that have their identity, but sharing one common democratic regime. There are many multicultural countries in the world. I mean, one of them is Canada next door, the Francophiles and Anglophiles. You have the UK that has the English, the Scots, the Welsh, and the Northern Irish in one democratic country. There's always tensions, of course, and nothing is perfect, and sometimes systems decide to change, like Czechoslovakia, for example. That's legitimate. But right now, it seems to me that we've got to find a way to have these two peoples live together in one democratic country. Otherwise, we have a new apartheid regime in the world, and I would hope that not only for progressives, but for everybody, including the mainstream Jewish community, apartheid would be unacceptable. The idea that Jews become Afrikaners is a pretty chilling prospect, I think.
But you still have a colonialist state. You still have reactionary Zionism and expansionist philosophy. How do you begin that process of taking apart, which is a calcified positioning, expansionist, colonialist, inherently xenophobic and racist, therefore? Is that any more real towards the recognition of finally of Palestinians' rights as is equal in, of course, the territory that they have been dispossessed of?
Well, if you look at South Africa, they were three players as well. They were the black Africans, the majority. They were the white, especially the Afrikaners, but the white population that ruled in a neo-colonial situation, and the international community. And the strategy of the ANC was to, I mean, they had obviously the support of the black community, was to mobilize the international community, trade unions, intellectuals, churches, human rights organizations, the UN, governments, getting to all these international players and simply making apartheid unsustainable, forcing the white minority to give up apartheid. I mean, the whites would not have given up apartheid proactively unless they had been forced to do so. What made that possible was already in 1955. Now, we're only talking about 7 years after the start of apartheid in 1948. In 1955, the ANC already had its freedom charter that said our vision of a new South Africa is inclusive of everyone. Now, they all didn't agree on that. Winnie Mandela didn't agree. Steve Biko didn't agree. You had people that said, no, this is a neo-colonial regime or a colonial regime, and South Africa should go back to the black people when we end apartheid. But the ANC said that would be too disruptive of South Africa, and they bit that bullet. And I think that this is where we are here. I think we can we can mobilize. A lot of the international community is mobilized. Look at the BDS movement, for example. Jewish Voice for Peace and other organizations that are very progressive. I think the young Jewish generation is really turned off from Israel and is ready to move, but they have no direction. So that if we can mobilize the already mobilized, but give them a direction, political end game, which is one democratic state, I think we can mobilize the Palestinians around that, of course, and the international community, and then to basically, you know, the Israeli Jewish population is not going to be proactive. They're not going to cooperate with this, but you simply make it unsustainable. You know, it's a small country, and by providing a just solution, which a democratic state is, by providing for the security of Israelis, ironically, which is what you do if you recognize the collective rights of Israelis, and by presenting a positive, inclusive vision of where we're going together, I think you can create a situation where people will say in the world, yes, this is a way out. That's actually good for Israelis as well. It's going to be a very difficult sell, but I think in a way you have justice, you have a good political vision, and again, if it's framed the right way, and that is that it's Israel that has created this apartheid situation. So Israel has to be held accountable for what it's doing. You put all that together, I think you could create a fairly an effective campaign that could succeed.
Do you have partners in this effort? Right. Is the boycott, divestment, sanction movement on the ground there in support? Where does the Palestinian Authority? Where do the Palestinian partners come into this strategy and concern, Jeff?
Well, the Palestinians, especially the PLO, had a one-state solution since its beginning. Already in the 1960s, in 64, the Palestinian Liberation Organization was founded during all the years until 1988, when it actually adopted a two-state solution. It had a one-state solution as its program. So this is nothing new for Palestinians. Even their concept, and it's not a trick or anything, but they were very upfront about it. They said, we agree to a two-state solution, but we Palestinians see that as a stepping stone towards one state eventually. Once we get to know each other and trust each other and start to live together, we don't see the two-state solution as the end game, but rather as a stage towards one democratic state. So that's always been their program. Now, the Palestinian Authority does not accept that, and not in principle, but I think practically. You see, this is the problem with the Palestinians, I'll be honest. And it's a problem of our organization as well, to help trying to organize. And that is that a lot of the Palestinians today in the occupied territory know that the two-state solution is gone. They accept the idea of a one-state solution, but they feel that it's impossible. Start all over again, and we've got to buck the United States and the international system, and Israel won't be a Jewish country, and that's a non-starter. So they're really very depressed and down and despondent, and in a sense, in a very apolitical moment. The BDS campaign, I have to say, which is a very important campaign because it's kept this whole issue alive, does not advocate for any particular solution that I think is a weakness of the BDS campaign. What are we BDSing for? So I'm hoping that as we begin to articulate a joint vision, the BDS people will come on board, even though that might split the movement. But the point is, BDS is a tool. It's not a standalone movement. So where we are today is that we have a small group, an influential group of intellectuals and activists. You know, half or a little bit more than half are Palestinians. And I could give you names, but they're not names that are known outside of Palestine very much. Although there's some very important people, some activists, some professors, intellectuals, and so on. And then there's a number of Israelis as well. I mean, one of the Israelis is Ilan Pape, who's well known. Mm-hmm. Eitan Bronstein, who was the founder of Zuchrot, who's fairly well known. But again, we're local people more. We're not necessarily international stars. But within our communities, I think we have quite a bit of say. And so what we're doing is we're going to have a meeting in the UK at Ilan Pappi's center in Exeter, and we formulated a kind of a draft, a document of what we how we see the one state solution, the basic principles of a one state solution, and a strategy. And we're going to get more people together in Exeter and try to come out with a joint document. And if we can do that, then we will begin to go out and try to build a movement around it. And I really think we have a chance to do that, because I think, everybody knows the two-state solution's gone. Everybody knows. It's like Leonard Cohen's song. Everybody knows. Everybody knows, And if we can fill that vacuum with a positive, constructive, but really just alternative solution coming from the people themselves, and I think we can get a good number of Israelis involved, plus our Palestinian partners. That, I think, will help mobilize the international community. So it's a small movement now, but I think the moment is ripe. It's in the air, the one state. Even the New York Times had an article a couple of weeks ago about the one state solution being in the air. So I think we just have to flesh it out and come up with a joint vision, and then I think it'll have its own impact.
The question of Israel in the international community, and now with a formidable, aggressive partner from the most conservative perspective, who, among other things, sees Israel as a bulwark against Iran and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that become a serious impediment in terms of your conceptual framework, your efforts? There's certainly the Arab states have not been empathetic in any significant way. They've really deserted for decades the Palestinian cause. How do you look at that question of the prominence of and strategic backing of Israel towards impeding the accomplishment of setting up again, an egalitarian one state?
That was really what my book was about, my last book, War Against the People.
And I gave you that as a deliberate segue into War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification, one of the really important books that you need to read this year.
I asked the question that was it's been on my mind for years as an activist. How does Israel get away with this? The occupation is not popular in the world. You can photograph it. There's very brutal visual images. It goes, goes against the whole idea of human rights and international law, but even colonialism. This whole time is past 50, 60, 70 years ago. And yet Israel gets stronger and stronger in the international community. One of the major reasons that we haven't really focused on much that I do in my book is what I call Israel's security politics. And the Ministry of Defense in Israel has a policy it calls niche filling. In other words, it surveys the entire world, where Israel is the number two or three largest arms supplier to China and to India. So it surveys those powerful countries down to every little country and warlords. Warlords in the Congo, for example, that control precious minerals. There are also people that have a lot of clout, and Israel has ties with them, with militias in South Sudan, for example, with militias in Colombia and other Latin American countries. And it's not only military niche filling for Israel, but it has to do with security and policing. So we all know that the Ferguson police and the Missouri police and the St. Louis County police were trained partly by Israel. Israel has trained about 10,000 American policemen over the years, and there's very big programs, I won't get into that now, for training the American police. So that Israel, is military security, surveillance, policing across the board, from the most powerful country in the world down to the most powerful warlord in his particular district in somewhere. Israel delivers. It's a nuclear power that's never signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, has one of the largest and most sophisticated armies in the world, so it can fight conventional wars. But it's very good at what's called wars against the people, which is the kind of warfare that's being fought today. wars in Afghanistan, Somalia, you know, throughout Africa and Latin America and so on. There's dozens of wars against the people that are also, again, police wars, wars against the black people in the United States, wars against immigrants, wars against crime that also get into social issues as well and class issues. So I can go country by country, literally, and show you exactly how Israel contributes, in quotes, to the security of that of the elites of those countries, the governments and the business elites and the military elites of those countries. And that's what explains, for example, Israel's love affair with Saudi Arabia today, or with Egypt, or with the Gulf states, or with China and India and Brazil. In other words, the BRICS countries that are supposed to be this counter-hegemonic bloc against Euro-America are completely being supplied by Israel and are becoming very pro-Israel in international forums. When you put arms and security and policing into the political equation, it creates strange bedfellows. And then what I do in my book, just to, because it's even a bigger story, and that is global capitalism. Because as capitalism becomes goes more and more into crisis, and it's unsustainable, and you have the income disparities we have, and more people are being excluded, not only people in the third world, as it's called, but middle-class kids in the United States, the whole Occupy movement. As this continues, capitalism has to become more coercive. And this is precisely wars against the people. Wars today aren't wars against armies. They're wars against people that are being excluded from the system and that don't voluntarily agree to be excluded, and they resist. And that's one reason, of course, why resistance is called terrorism. You know, it all kind of fits together. But Israel is really on top of that. I would say that Israel is probably the leading thinker, if you can think of a country as a thinker, in terms of being on the cutting edge with the language, with the framing, with the concerns, the fears, what's happening in the world, the migration patterns, the scarce resources that are being competed for, the need for capital flow to go into the global north, you know, the need for more security against people that are being excluded. All of these things Israel reads very well and has an appropriate type of military technology, what I call the technology of repression, to answer whatever particular security threat the elites have in any particular country. So that begins to explain the support that Israel gets. You know, because, again, you know, you can criticize Israel, but nobody's going to sanction Israel. And that's because Israel's part of the old boys network, where Israel will help you, the elites of your country and the global elites, to stay in power. Hmm. That's what I try to document in my book. So in some ways, the Palestinians become irrelevant. And that's, I think, part of Israel's message, is that, look, we can make a separate peace with the Arab world. We can play a useful role like this in the international community without ending the occupation, without the Palestinians.
Well, we will reconnect with Jeff after the extremely important meeting that's going to be taking place at Exeter in London, and want to again encourage people to take up the reading of War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification. We have been speaking with Jeff Halper, who is the head of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and working towards building an egalitarian landmass with all of the rights for those people who have been on the land and those who have occupied it for generations and are and continue to be disenfranchised. Jeff Halper, thank you for spending the time with us.
And I look forward to reporting back.
Good. We look forward to hearing that. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
According to a study by the Pew Research Center, LGBTQ people are the most likely minority group to be targeted by hate crimes, about twice as likely as black people.
The Jazz Age Harlem offered an openness and freedom for those in the life.
A historical novel set in the 1920s, the protagonist is a doctor who happens to be gay. It's my party and a pride I want to...
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Bermuda separates equality from marriage, hate on the rise horrifies queer youth, and culture heroes expand boundaries into rainbow minutes. All that and more this week, because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Monique Lukens.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 10th, 2018. Bermuda had the dubious distinction this week of becoming the first country on Earth to repeal marriage equality. After weeks of deliberation, Governor John Rankin gave royal assent on February 7th to Bermuda's Domestic Partnership Act 2017. The Queen's official approval, through the governor of the British Overseas Territory, was required before the bill could become law. Royal assent is almost always a simple formality. The measure overturned a May 2017 marriage equality ruling by the island nation's Supreme Court and replaced it with a separate domestic partnership option for same-gender couples. The current government, bolstered by loud and vocal evangelical Christian leaders, made overturning the court's equality ruling an issue during the subsequent campaign last year. Minister of Home Affairs Walton Brown claims that domestic partners will have all the rights of heterosexual married couples. Equality proponents disagree. Bermuda is, of course, highly dependent on tourism. For better or worse, calls for boycotts, which would impact LGBT Bermudans who work in those businesses, too, have already begun.
It's of little solace to Winston Godwin and Greg DeRoche, whose lawsuit led to the Bermuda High Court ruling, that the bill allowed them and about a half dozen other queer couples who wed after the ruling to stay legally married. Mark Pettengill, the country's former attorney general, successfully argued the Godwin-DeRoche case before the Supreme Court. He said he hoped that other litigants would step forward to launch a legal challenge to the new law. He told the Royal Gazette that, "We are dealing with something that became legal on the basis of human rights issues and is now being effectively taken away by an act of Parliament. It presents a far tougher case and a far longer and potentially more drawn-out battle." Opposition parties in Britain and politicians in groups from inside and outside the UK have condemned the government's royal assent. Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, with whom Governor Rankin is said to have consulted, said that he decided that it was not appropriate for the government to veto a decision by the island's lawmakers.
The Reuters news agency reported this week that some 200 unlicensed clinics to cure same-gender sexual attraction are doing big business in Ecuador. Despite gay sex being decriminalized there in 1997, clinic operators claim that homosexuality is a mental illness that needs corrective therapy. Caetano Salal, a spokesperson for one of the country's leading LGBT advocacy groups, said that the clinics operate clandestinely in private alcohol and drug rehabilitation facilities. Queer or questioning victims are usually forced into the clinic by family members and held against their will. Activists charge that they are routinely raped and beaten as part of the therapy. A spokeswoman for Ecuador's health ministry told Reuters that, "We frequently verify with our teams that these types of establishments do not exist where human rights violations can take place." But Salao called the existence of the clinics a reality that the government seemingly doesn't want to face. Activists are calling on the nation's courts to intervene and fully eradicate the medically debunked practice. Although Ecuador passed a law in 2016 allowing people to choose their preferred gender on identity cards, and its first transgender lawmaker took office last year, socially conservative attitudes are entrenched in the South American nation, bolstered by the increasingly powerful evangelical wing of the Roman Catholic Church.
A former television journalist and evangelical Christian singer and lawmaker bolted to the top of the first round of presidential elections in Costa Rica on February 4th. Political observers credit the meteoric rise of Fabricio Alvarado in a crowded field of 13 candidates to his outspoken condemnation of the January Inter-American Court of Human Rights ruling that said civil marriage should be opened to same-gender couples throughout the region. With about 90% of the precincts reporting, the nation's electoral board said that the 43-year-old Alvarado had won 25% of the vote. He'll face marriage equality supporter and former Labor Minister Carlos Quesada in a runoff election. At the age of 38, the youngest in the race, Quesada came in second with 22%. Alvarado managed to upend the usual political debates about corruption, crime, and the economy to make opposition to marriage equality in the heavily Roman Catholic Central American country his campaign centerpiece. He called the Inter-American Court ruling, which had actually been requested by the current government, a violation of Costa Rica's sovereignty and an affront to traditional family values. Public opinion polls suggest that a majority of respondents in Costa Rica who had heard about the ruling agree with him. The runoff election will be held on April 1st.
The Trump administration announced this week that the president's new policy on military service by transgender Americans would be introduced on February 21st. That's the deadline Trump gave Defense Secretary James Mattis to submit an implementation plan to ban future enlistment by transgender people and perhaps even discharge currently serving transgender enlistees. The Obama administration opened service to qualified transgender personnel after a comprehensive study of the issue by the Pentagon that determined that their integration into the armed forces would not pose a challenge to morale or good order. A separate study by the RAND Corporation also disputed one of Trump's rationales for the ban by concluding that associated health care costs would also be minimal. Human Rights Campaign National Press Secretary Sarah McBride pointed out in a media statement that there has already been an extensive and thorough study of allowing transgender people to serve openly, a process which led the Pentagon 2 years ago to announce that the United States would join 18 other nations that allow open trans service. In their repeated attempts to implement and justify this cruel and unconstitutional policy, the statement charges, the Trump-Pence administration has been the only source of disruption on this issue. Activists look to the federal courts to block any attempted ban. A number of judges have already issued temporary injunctions to prevent Trump's proposal from going forward.
More out and proud athletes from around the world are competing in the Winter Olympic Games than ever before. The 2018 edition in Pyeongchang, South Korea, kicked off this week with at least 14 openly LGBT competitors. Perhaps two of the more high-profile queer Olympians are U.S. freestyle skier Gus Kenworthy and figure skater Adam Rippon. Rippon made headlines by rejecting an offer from Vice President Mike Pence's office for a face-to-face meeting during the Games. He had criticized the fact that Pence was to lead the U.S. delegation, pointing to the former Indiana governor's support for so-called cure therapy and his several other anti-LGBT actions. Kenworthy agreed with Rippon during an appearance on Ellen DeGeneres' daytime talk show this week.
We're going into the Olympics, and myself and Adam Rippon are the two first openly gay males competing in the Olympics, and it's just incredible to see how times have changed because of people like you and athletes in the past and so many people that have paved the way. But then to have someone leading the delegation that's like directly attacked the LGBT community and just a cabinet in general that just sort of stands against us and has tried to do things to set us back, it just seems like a bad fit. And I feel like the Olympics is all about inclusion and people coming together, and it seems like it's not really doing that.
Friends Kenworthy and Rippon posted photos on Instagram this week from South Korea, one showing Kenworthy giving Rippon a peck on the cheek with the caption, "Eat your heart out, Pence." There were reports that the vice president continues to pursue a face-to-face meeting with Rippon. The gay figure skater said he was open to that, but only after the Olympics. "I've been waiting 28 years to be here," he said, "and I want to do everything I can to stay focused and ready for this opportunity." You can follow all the queer action at the Winter Olympics on many of your favorite LGBT news outlets, including Outsports.com.
And finally, fans of America's National Football League, Philadelphia Eagles, flocked to Minneapolis on February 4th for the Super Bowl, where their team upset the defending champion New England Patriots. Because it's named the Eagle Bolt, several Philadelphia fans who couldn't get tickets to the game mistakenly mistook it for a fan watering hole. One told the Minneapolis Star Tribune that, "We were just walking around as we were looking for a bar. I said, we're stopping there. It says Eagle." The Eagle Bolt is a gay leather bar. Owner Ed Hopkins said that the Eagles fans who stumbled into it enjoyed being in our place. "They were very rowdy and fun. We enjoyed having them in our establishment." Sid Ziegler wrote on Outsports.com that, "You don't have to be gay to watch the Super Bowl in a gay bar. You just have to be cool. And it sounds like a bunch of cool Eagles fans had the night of their lives in a gay bar called Eagle."
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending February 10th, 2018. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap, from This Way Out, is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Monique Lukens.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
Young love, our love we share with deep emotion.
Hello, I'm Tab Hunter, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all of our sexually diverse communities.
Black entertainers rubbed elbows with homosexuals and transvestites, which was considered quite chic.
I am the first to admit that I like to see myself reflected on the page, but I am also captivated by the lives of characters who are different than me.
You don't own me.
You too will be rubbing elbows with homosexuals in Harlem, and even an author and an iconic entertainer. But first, some queer young people who should be thinking about life and love have hate on their minds.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Nico, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Andrea talks about Matthew Shepard, who became a victim of a deadly assault because he was gay. His murder highlights a historic lack of legal protections for LGBTQ people. Andrea talks about how this injustice has partially been lessened by new laws and awareness, yet has also continued in many ways. In 1998, a 21-year-old openly gay college student named Matthew Shepard was kidnapped by two men his age. They drove him to an out-of-the-way part of town, punched him repeatedly, and hit him about 20 times with the butt of a pistol. They left him tied to a fence, unconscious and mangled, until he was found 18 hours later. He was brought to the hospital, and he died 6 days after the attack. Matthew Shepard's murder attracted enormous media attention because of suspicions that his sexuality was the motivation for the crime, particularly because his attackers repeatedly used anti-gay slurs throughout their confessions and testimony. The murder of Matthew Shepard is an example of a hate crime. The FBI defines a hate crime as a criminal offense against a person or property motivated in whole or in part by an offender's bias against race, religion, disability, sexual orientation, ethnicity, gender, or gender identity. It's important to note that simply hating someone is not illegal, as it falls within one's right to freedom of expression. But committing a crime based on hatred of a minority group is an act often meant to terrorize an entire community, and it's not protected free expression. It's a criminal action against a member of a group that's motivated by hate of that group.
That makes it a hate crime, and the designation of a crime as a hate crime can increase the punishment or allow more resources to be provided for prosecution. At the time of Matthew Shepard's murder in 1998, there was no hate crime law in Wyoming, the state in which the crime occurred, so his attackers were not convicted of a hate crime. Additionally, federal hate crime law did not cover crimes motivated by sexual orientation. Federal hate crime law at the time did not cover crimes motivated by sexual orientation. As a result, when the local police department asked for resources from the federal government, the U.S. Department of Justice couldn't help. In 2009, President Obama signed the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act. It expanded federal hate crime law to include crimes motivated by sexual orientation or gender identity, and it altered the existing law to help the federal government better provide resources to address all hate crimes. If the law had been in place in 1998, the federal government would have been able to allocate resources to the prosecution of Matthew Shepard's murderers. Part of the rationale behind hate crime laws protecting LGBTQ people is that we are statistically much more likely to become victims. Perhaps one of the most disturbing statistics is that about half of all transgender people and bisexual women experience sexual assault at some point in their lifetimes. People who are members of multiple minority groups are at the highest risk. According to the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs, about 62% of all LGBTQ homicide victims are people of color. Many minority groupings come with an increased risk of being a crime victim, and hate crime laws can increase punishment for crimes motivated by prejudice against these minorities, hopefully as a deterrent. Unfortunately, hate crimes in America are not uncommon, especially against LGBTQ people. According to a study by the Pew Research Center, LGBTQ people are the most likely minority group to be targeted by hate crimes, about twice as likely as Black people. It gets worse. According to the National Coalition on Anti-Violence report, there was a record number of anti-LGBTQ homicides in 2017. Experts believe that a major cause of this increase is that society is becoming more accepting of people's differences. Because of this, those who are against LGBTQ people might feel marginalized and are therefore more likely to commit violent crimes against them. While these statistics provide some perspective on the occurrence of hate crimes in the United States, they do not paint the complete picture. It is likely that hundreds, if not thousands, of hate crimes go unreported each year. People may be afraid of outing themselves by reporting these crimes, and even when they are reported, many local jurisdictions may not consider them hate crimes, so they pass unnoticed. The crime and discrimination LGBTQ people face is serious. Homophobic and transphobic crime increases the marginalization and fear that LGBTQ people may feel about being open about themselves, not to mention the lives it takes and the harm that it does to the well-being of the LGBTQ community and the people in it. As of January 2018, all but four of the U.S. states have hate crime laws. Of those, only 30 states cover crimes motivated by sexual orientation, and only 17 states cover crimes motivated by gender identity. Increased hate crime protections would help bring justice against discriminatory crime, help prevent it from occurring, and help make all LGBTQ people safer. The Matthew Shepard murder happened before I was born, but it's disheartening that violent crimes against LGBTQ people are as much of an issue today as they were then, despite the incredible progress that we've made in many other areas. Despite all of the ways in which we are safer now than we were years ago, acts of terror against our community make every one of us think, that could be me. It raises questions about the safety of coming out, of being open about who we are, of simply walking down the street or going to a gay bar or coffee house or bookstore. For many LGBTQ people, the balance of how open to be is a difficult one. Fear of facing violence pushes that balance more towards the side of being afraid to say certain things, wear certain things, or go certain places that could let people know that we're LGBTQ. For a community that has fought so hard for the right to be open about who we are, more stress and fear about whether it's safe is the last thing we need.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is heard online at outcastingmedia.org, on iTunes, and on more than 50 public radio stations around the country. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Our assistant producers are Alex Mintz and Josh Valley, and our executive producer is Mark Sovos. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Like a shooting star, flying across the room, so fast, so far, gone too soon.
Hello, I am Dennis Shepherd, Matthew Shepherd's father, and you are listening to This Way Out.
Make a new acquaintance and remember some golden oldies later in the program. What was it like to be in the life during the Harlem Renaissance? Let's ask the Rainbow Minute crew.
The Harlem Renaissance, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Known as one of the most culturally romantic periods in American history, the Harlem Renaissance would leave a lasting impression. It all began in the very early 1900s when a large migration of Southern blacks transformed the neighborhood just north of New York City's Central Park into the most populous African-American community in the country. By the 1920s, Harlem had become the epicenter of black American art, music, and literature, and soon was exploding with nightlife. The Jazz Age Harlem offered an openness and freedom for those in the life, the term often used for those attracted to their own sex. While the word homosexual was never mentioned, gays and lesbians found a place to flourish. It became fashionable for white partygoers from Manhattan to seek the exotic, unrestrained nightlife of Harlem, where social restrictions were often left at the door. They went to basement speakeasies or to cabarets like the Cotton Club. There, black entertainers rubbed elbows with homosexuals and transvestites, which was considered quite chic. Many partygoers were gay themselves, meeting in Harlem bars that catered to the black and white, the heterosexual and homosexual. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Anna Edwards.
LGBT books are more than just an obsession for This Way Out's Queer Life and Literature commentator Janet Mason, and Jeff Stuckey's novel Acquaintance reveals why.
One evening before a class I teach, I was telling an adult student that I review LGBT books. I live in a very diverse area where it doesn't seem to matter if you're gay, and I've been coming out to my students for so long that it feels like breathing. This particular student was a little different than the others. She was around my age, so if she had done her homework or at least paid attention over the years, she would have known that there was a time not so long ago when coming out was not so easy. She sniffed in a way that let me know that she didn't have a cold and responded, "Really? Only LGBT books?" Then without pausing, she added rather disdainfully, I thought, "I guess that's your thing." I find LGBT books to be more interesting. I want to know how people survive and often thrive outside the box in a culture that is based on conformity. I didn't say this because my student may have found it to be a defensive statement. Maybe it is. Perhaps it is because I am a lesbian that I find diversity to be more interesting. I am the first to admit that I like to see myself reflected on the page, but I am also captivated by the lives of characters who are different than me. Recently, I opened the pages of a book that had come across my desk and was reminded of this. The book is titled Acquaintance, a novel, part of Medicine for the Blues trilogy, and is by Jeff Stuckey, Pictograph Publishing, Portland, Oregon, 2017. A historical novel set in the 1920s, the protagonist is a doctor who happens to be gay. It is a love story written in a time when gay love was clandestine. As the author writes, "Love stories get especially messy when the love is forbidden. The story of Romeo and Juliet would have been a simple one if their families had not made their love dangerous. But love will flourish even when it is forbidden. In the novel, I learned about gay life way before the liberation unleashed by the Stonewall Riots in New York City in 1969. I also learned about the medical profession, fishing, Portland, Oregon, music, especially jazz, and the origins of the Ku Klux Klan. There is an interesting subplot regarding the connection between racism and homophobia, and another subplot addresses the realistically drawn lesbian couple in the narrator's life, of whom he is jealous of before he settles down with his male partner. Acquaintance is a well-developed and interesting page-turner, and I'm looking forward to reading the rest of the trilogy. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
And finally this week...
It's still Leslie Gore's party, coming up now on The Rainbow Minute. Leslie Gore was discovered at age 16 by producer Quincy Jones during a gig at a Manhattan hotel. He signed her to Mercury Records and in 1963 released the number one hit, It's My Party. Gore's remarkable run of hits like Judy's Turn to Cry spoke of teenage crushes and betrayals, securing her place as a teen pop icon.
Don't own me, I'm not just one of your many toys.
Her second biggest hit was You Don't Own Me. Some considered it a feminist anthem since she crooned, "To live my life the way I want, to say and do whatever I please." Gore later hosted a couple of episodes of In the Life, a gay and lesbian news series on PBS, and started talking publicly about her life as a lesbian. It was her way of offering solace to gays and lesbians in the Midwest who had no one to talk to. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Jed Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Gene Pembleton.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Monique Lukens and Christopher Gall, produced by Steve Pride, Outcasters Nico and Andrea, produced by Mark Sofos, Anna Edwards and Gene Pembleton, produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and Janet Mason. Between the Lions and Leslie Gore performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This layout thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Frentham, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org. And on CITR Vancouver, British Columbia, Dade City Community Radio, Dade City, Florida, WRFN Nashville, Tennessee, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In the mid-20th century, psychotherapy was seen as a path to both personal and social transformation. Today, traditional talk therapy is an endangered species. My guest argues that rather than lengthy, in-depth sessions between patient and practitioner, most people grappling with personal anguish are now prescribed drugs, most frequently by non-psychiatrist physicians, or instructed in short-term cognitive behavior therapy. In his book, Saving Talk Therapy, How Health Insurers, Big Pharma, and Slanted Science Are Ruining Good Mental Health Care, clinical psychologist Enrico Gnaolatti makes the case for psychotherapy. He suggests that the tradition of talk therapy has been liberatory on both the individual and societal level, as seen in the 1960s, and that its scarcity has ethical implications. Enrico, we'll be speaking in this hour about why talk therapy appears to be in decline. But I'd like to start by asking you, how can we measure its decline numerically? Is there good data on how many people actually go to therapy?
Yeah, I think what you have to do is just sort of grab at different kinds of data sets to really buttress any solid proposition that talk therapy is in decline. First off, by talk therapy, I don't mean, let's just say in general. So there's been about a 20% decline in the past several decades in the average number of sessions that a given client receives. It used to be about 10, now it's around 8. So there's that going on. The dropout rates are at an all-time high. So about 80% of people will discontinue therapy before receiving about 10 sessions, even though the most conservative estimates of the number of sessions it takes for even minimal progress to be achieved in therapy, it hovers around like the 20 session mark. So about 80% of people drop out at the 10 session mark. Only about 16% of people receive that magical 20 number. So you've got that going on. There's more people will take medications alone without psychotherapy than previously was the case. So something in the region of about 60% of people will take meds only without any talk therapy. So you have that going on. And these numbers point to just an overall decline in the amount of therapy, the length of therapy that people are getting, the decline in the quality of the psychotherapy that the average American is currently receiving compared to the previous generation. And that's a whole other separate topic.
Well, when did therapy peak then? What has been the trajectory, and we will talk in a moment about the origins of talk therapy, but what has been the trajectory in the United States in the 20th century, in the 21st century, you're saying it's been in decline, but in the 20th century in terms of the popularity of talk therapy?
I would say that it peaked in popularity leading up to the advent of Prozac. So Prozac was released in 1987. I argue that the peak was, around the time of the release of the one movie, Ordinary People, where Jed Hirsch got the Oscar for his role as a psychotherapist in that movie. And that movie, in my estimation, kind of typifies what the sort of the treasured cultural experience that psychotherapy once was in America, and that frankly most Americans still think of when they think about going into therapy. So in that movie, he's this, real, caring, thoughtful, dedicated, devoted psychotherapist who's willing to kind of dig in with client issues, like really press and probe to get at traumas that need to be processed, where there needs to be some cathartic release of emotion. And so you have that going on in the culture leading right into the advent of Prozac, which is in the late 80s. And Prozac was marketed to primary care physicians, like non-psychiatrist physicians, because it was marketed as supposedly a safe drug. Compared to the previous generation of antidepressants, it was seen like as a drug that had very few side effects, certainly lethal ones, like the older antidepressants, what are called the tricyclics. You could swallow a handful of them and it would have lethal effects, whereas, as the saying goes, you can swallow 100 Prozac and just have a tummy ache. And so these sorts of data points were pushed by Eli Lilly to primary care physicians, shifting the front line of mental health treatment to primary care physicians. Whereas prior to that, primary care physicians would refer out to psychotherapists if a client started sobbing or a patient started sobbing in their office about a broken marriage or a difficult divorce or a tyrannical boss. So from then on in, primary care physicians were more likely to reach for the prescription pad rather than to make a referral out to psychotherapists. And so you have that going on, and then you have changes in the delivery of healthcare, managed care, that really coincided with the release of Prozac. That was sort of Prozac was the one punch. Managed care, what was happening with managed care, was the sort of the 1-2 punch.
Well, let's talk about the origins of talk therapy. What are they? Obviously, tied to the seminal figure Sigmund Freud.
Yeah, I mean, actually, when I was researching my book, I went back and read Freud's first book that he wrote with Breuer called Studies in Hysteria, and I found it absolutely fascinating that the early Freud was really really gripped by clients' stories and really trying to do the detective work and to piece together sort of repressed traumas, repressed experience that once recalled, recollected, and frankly, cathartically processed, emotionally processed, gave clients relief. And, you know, as Freud himself developed his grand psychoanalytic theory, I think he became unmoored from some of those important original practices. Freud actually, over time, was completely disinterested in psychoanalysis as being a treatment to relieve human suffering. In fact, he joked about that. He had very little interest in that, was dismissive of his neurotic patients, really saw them as an opportunity to make a living and to help him garner information to develop his theories. So he thought that psychoanalysis was really a process by which you could gain understanding, self-understanding, not a kind of a liberating emotional experience. In fact, in my book, that I argue that the first person that talk therapy had to be rescued from was Freud himself, and it was a Hungarian psychoanalyst by the name of Sándor Ferenczi who really put a human face on psychoanalysis, and it was his brand of psychoanalytic psychotherapy that made it its way to the United States and pre-war, post-war America, and influenced a whole generation of psychotherapists.
Right. So what you're suggesting is that there is a deeply humanist thread that goes through psychotherapy and talk therapy that came to the United States and was influential in mid-century. Tell us about that tradition and why you think the humanism of that approach made so much sense.
In an American context, I think that, you know, you have to look to the 60s and the cultural transformations going on in the United States that then had an influence on how psychotherapy was practiced. And then in turn, what psychotherapy had to offer itself in promoting important democratic ways of thinking, or actually ways of thinking is the wrong way of putting it, but I have a chapter on psychotherapy and the social good. And many of the ideas contained in there are an attempt on my part to revive arguments made in the 60s about the importance of psychotherapy. Things like that psychotherapy is an important, perhaps unmatched, perhaps unsurpassed, treasured cultural space to acquire an authentic self, to be able to access and articulate true thoughts and feelings about things without needing to worry about typical social consequences to that, and to be able then to solidly be anchored to kind of true self experiences that are the foundational for true individuality. And I think for a healthy democracy, you need a large population of healthy individuals who can think for themselves, act for themselves, who are not primarily motivated out of fear, are not primarily motivated out of compliance, and so therefore can think and act both with tradition and with existing authority structures and against existing authority structures and tradition. And that whole way of thinking about psychotherapy really can be traced back to the 60s and was one of the reasons it was such a valuable, popular enterprise in the 60s.
Well, taking us to the years before the 60s, how did talk therapy grow in popularity in the mid-20th century in the U.S.?
Really, ironically, due to the Second World War. So During the war, there were a large number of military personnel on the front lines who would become traumatized by war events. And the top brass realized quickly that they needed to do kind of on-the-spot interventions to address trauma or what was called battle fatigue. And as it was occurring in the field, and so had mental health personnel fan out all over the European theater and the Pacific theater of wars and really be on the spot to help traumatized soldiers. And that in combination with an understanding by leading politicians in post-war America, that there were, you know, large segments of the population who had been at war, who were returning, and the transition to civilian life by, you know, legions of military personnel, that would be distressing. Families that had endured separation from loved ones, that would be distressing. That there was a need to really provide psychotherapy, you know, freely and cost-effectively to the American public at large. And so there was a massive investment by the federal government in mental health in post-war America.
That's the voice of Enrico Gnaulati. He's a clinical psychologist, and we're talking about his book, Saving Talk Therapy. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, you've just described sort of the trajectory of talk therapy in the United States, how it came to get widespread traction, and then, of course, as you say, how it helped shape the 1960s and the liberatory impulses both socially and individually in that time and became more and more accepted and mainstream. But I wanted to ask you, obviously you are making the argument that talk therapy, which is now in decline, needs to be defended and needs to be made widely accessible to people instead of short-term fixes or medications. But what is the evidence that talk therapy actually works?
There's lots of evidence that it works. I could start quoting studies if you want me to, but how about I zero in on one? It's a study out of the Tavistock Clinic in London. It's called the Tavistock Adult Depression Study, where they provided long-term psychoanalytically oriented psychotherapy, and I can define that in a minute if you want, to persons who had intractable depression, where they had tried lots of different things and nothing seemed to work. And they discovered that when given about 18 months of weekly in-depth psychotherapy, at 2 years after therapy ended, about 44% of those people no longer met the criteria for serious depression. They got better compared to only about 10% of people in the study who had treatment as usual, which was essentially medication and short-term cognitive behavioral psychotherapy. So, you know, that's just one of a handful of studies. The long-term studies don't get done for obvious reasons. They're far more costly and logistically complicated to conduct than a study that, say, is 12 weeks in length, which is typical for psychotherapy studies that are pitted against medication studies and randomized controlled trials. These types of short-term quick fix therapies, I think, are overstudied because they're less expensive to conduct and less logistically complicated. And frankly, and this is where I'm going to alienate a lot of my academic colleagues, frankly, academics who really in a publisher parish environment where they have to turn around studies quickly and get them published for their own professional survival, there's a selective mechanism in place that favors and privileges this type of research over the longer-term studies that really look at long-term models and track people's recovery over the long term, not just symptom reduction over the short term, but social and emotional well-being of people over the long term. And so, yes, that's a long-winded way of saying there's plenty of evidence to not only just suggest, but really corroborate that psychotherapy does work.
How would you describe how talk therapy is practiced in the main today and the way that it ideally has been practiced in the past? Because what you're suggesting is that it takes time.
Correct. I would say that there's been a shift in the field favoring short-term cognitive behavioral models of care. And there really are giant qualitative differences between more humanistic psychoanalytic models of psychotherapy and cognitive behavioral ones.
Can you define what that means, what cognitive behavioral therapy is?
So practiced in its least sophisticated ways, and frankly, there's a saturation of these models these days, especially in the Veterans Administration system and in college counseling centers across the country, which together train the vast majority of psychotherapies, not only in the U.S., but in the world. And so there are a lot of these researched, they're called forms of evidence-based treatment, and they're adopted by these systems because of that, because it's presumed that that's the best that science has to offer, and why shouldn't we be offering that? But when you really dig more deeply into these models, they really are anemic forms of therapy. So usually they're time limited, not uncommonly about 12 weeks, 16 weeks. They're practiced in a kind of a protocol-driven way. They're manualized. There's certain things you should be doing on session one, session two, session three. Clients get worksheets. There's progress is measured in terms of symptom reduction. Not uncommonly, along the way, clients are supposed to fill out symptom checklists, either on a sheet of paper or on a laptop somewhere. Watch these sessions being practiced and also interview therapists practicing in these systems, which I've done, and I've published articles on that. You see how, you know, there really is not the deep listening, the patient listening, the therapist poised as the sort of a serene presence who's not there to anticipate what clients are going to talk about or should be talking about, but are truly listening and letting clients, there's not a lot of that going on, letting clients tell their story at their own pace in a scattershot, jumbled fashion, seemingly rambling fashion, as distressed human beings are apt to do. With cognitive behavioral therapy, it's more about really shunting the discussion in terms of symptoms, what can be done to reduce those symptoms, thinking errors, dysfunctional thinking patterns that are thought to be the cause of those symptoms, and zeroing in, addressing those. And it has an air of productivity and efficiency and busyness about it. But I argue in my book that these may be seductive to clients because they think that they're getting somewhere, because in our current cultural zeitgeist, you know, in the workplace, there's a lot of focus on measuring progress and accountability and getting the job done. And so there's a strange, insidious a cultural fit between what's valued in the world of business and what is offered in the therapy office in the way of cognitive behavioral therapy that seduces a lot of clients into thinking that they're getting something productive and constructive. I would say no, these forms of therapy really don't address long-lasting, meaningful change in psychotherapy.
And you write that cognitive behavioral therapy is framed and supported by people who say, well, it's evidence-based. And not long ago, you were arguing that the studies are skewed against longer-term talk therapy, partly because they're short-term studies. So what can be said about the effectiveness of this approach that you're just criticizing, cognitive behavioral therapy, given that you seem to be arguing that the research is likely to favor it? Are there other studies that point in a different direction?
There are people in the field right now who are reanalyzing data sets on the outcome research with cognitive behavioral therapy. And there are more and more studies coming out saying that really these studies are not as effective as we once believed. That is when you look at the long-term benefits, not short-term remediation, but long-term benefits. So there are studies that show that, for instance, about a third of depressed people given short-term cognitive behavioral therapy relapse within a year, over 50% within 2 years. There's some studies that show that as few as like 7 to 24% really of depressed people who get short-term CBT show sustained recovery over the long term. And so once again, when you start to look at when you start to define progress, not just in terms of like a reduction in symptoms of anxiety and depression, and frankly, people go into therapy, that's an inadequate measure of progress for therapists in the field and for clients. The average client goes into therapy not to become less anxious and less, not to have fewer pessimistic thoughts, but to be a more optimistic person. You know, they go into therapy not to feel less helpless in their life, but to feel more empowered and to have a stronger, longer lasting sense of personal agency. Too many of these studies define progress in very narrow ways that have actually little appeal to clients and less appeal to therapists like myself who are practicing in the field and have for decades. So they really shortchange the American public, and I think they shortchange, the profession.
When you say that there are high dropout rates for therapy now, does that include cognitive behavioral therapy, or are you talking about more extended types of therapy?
It's really hard to get accurate data on all of that. Usually they're all lumped together, Sasha, and so it's hard to tease apart, you know. But certainly there are data sets that show that the dropout rates are less with skilled therapists who are trained in the right thing. And frankly, where there's a lot of data to suggest that. So therapists that are skilled at showing empathy, who are genuine with clients, who come across as devoted listeners, who are good at building rapport with clients, the dropout rates with therapists like that are far less, and ironically, even though there's an abundance of research going back all the way to Carl Rogers, actually, that show that these more humanistic aspects of the practice of therapy predict positive outcome, they are not getting the press. Those data sets are not getting the press that they deserve inside and outside of academia.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with clinical psychologist Enrico Gnaolatti. He's the author of Saving Talk Therapy, How Health Insurers, Big Pharma, and Slanted Science Are Ruining Good Mental Health Care. That's published by Beacon Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. And I'm Sasha Lilly. Well, let's talk more about medication, because you argue that one of the main factors in the decline of talk therapy in the United States is personal physicians prescribing medication to patients who come in with symptoms of depression or anxiety. Tell us about the rise of drugs like Prozac.
Prozac really set the precedent for the next generation of medications. And so drug companies got very clever in marketing medications just to non-psychiatrist doctors who then felt comfortably, who then were more inclined than to medicalize psychological problems and see it within their wheelhouse to treat with supposed safe medications like Prozac and its cousins like Paxil, Zoloft, Celexa, and so on. So you can really trace the onset of a more profound medicalization pattern and how mental health problems were both framed and treated from Prozac onwards. We're seeing a little bit of a backlash against that right now, believe it or not. It's commonly accepted that there are no big blockbuster drugs, in the pipe. There's even within the National Institute of Mental Health an awareness that research that is rooted in client diagnoses and then drugs to treat those diagnoses are problematic because diagnoses are it's so difficult to get inter-rater reliability and agreement on diagnoses. So there's less of an emphasis on drug research and psychotherapy research and the treatment of diagnoses. They're trying to define mental health problems more broadly. And there's that transition going on. There's there being fewer and fewer blockbuster drugs. And there's an opening there to really for psychotherapy to rediscover its footing. There's more and more bad press coming out about medications. There was a phenomenal book written by Irving Hirsch going back about 5 or 6 years where he reanalyzed a lot of data sets through the FDA and makes the argument that for most SSRI antidepressants are about as effective as placebos. Abilify, which was the most profitable drug sold of all drugs in 2013, as a augmentation therapy for depression. If your SSRI doesn't work, take Abilify. There's a Consumer Reports site that came out not that long ago saying that Abilify really isn't that effective as a form of augmentation therapy. So you're seeing more and more a questioning of the beneficial effects of medication, which is not to say that they aren't hugely beneficial when used for true mental illnesses, and an awareness of side effect profiles are taken into consideration. I'm not an anti-psychiatry person.
So just to be clear then, are you saying that for people who have serious mental health disorders, that these drugs work not as a placebo, but genuinely work, and that for people who don't fall into that category, they don't, just to try and make sense of what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, all of that actually is hard to tease apart. But I would say that for people who, first off, you should know that there's solid research to show that people who, for instance, have protracted depression that really benefit most from a combination of medications and psychotherapy. And that right now, only about 20% of people will take meds and be in psychotherapy. About 60% of people will take meds without any talk therapy. So I think that's important to say just to get a context here in terms of how skewed the delivery of care is right now. So many people who are given meds, who take meds, will often acclimate to being on meds. In my experience, maybe about a third of people will have qualitatively different life experiences that make them want to stay on it. about a third of people in my experience are on it, and they're not really sure if it's helping or not, but they're too scared to get off of it. And then about a third of people just don't benefit, and the side effects are worse than the actual symptoms that they were taking the medication to treat in the first place. So it's and you know, most people these days, taking medications is not a casual choice. It's often a devil's choice. About a third of people will not that take an antidepressant won't fill their prescription. So it's not like people are, I would argue, casually taking meds, believing that these are going to be a silver bullet, and then, you know, and then they end up being a silver bullet. I think for most people, they go to the primary care physician who's the one who's perhaps a little too casual and proposing medications, and then clients will go along with that because it's a convenient option, or it appears to be, and then from there it will have the effects that I just mentioned more often than not.
It sounds like what you're saying is that it's not the patients who are clamoring for these drugs, even though drug companies have had a fairly long history now of, in the last several decades, of trying to market directly to the general public. But it sounds like what you're saying is that this is coming primarily from non-psychiatrist physicians.
Yes. I mean, I think these days only about fifth. Actually, most of the psychiatric drugs being prescribed in the United States right now, upwards of 80%, are by non-psychiatrist physicians, not just primary care physicians, internists, cardiologists, OBGYNs. And I think they have good intentions. They want to be helpful. They're under a time crunch with patients in the room who are distressed. They want to do something. They believe that these medications have been around. Well, they have been around for decades. They believe they're safe, and they don't have toxic side effect profiles, and so they prescribe them. But actually, when it comes to the SSRIs like Prozac, Celexa, Zoloft, Paxil, actually, when you dig deeply into the research, the side effect profiles have actually been underreported. There are a lot of good studies out there showing that upwards of 60% of people put on an SSRI will have sexual side effects, often which are pretty profound, and really interfere with them having any kind of real pleasurable sex life.
What's the comparative cost of medication versus talk therapy of the kind that you're advocating, which is lengthy, open-ended, not short-term?
Very good question, Sasha. Up until recently, you know, some of these drugs, like Abilify, I believe now the patent has expired. What happens is that the blockbuster drugs come out. They're extraordinarily expensive until their patent expires, and they're typically far more expensive than like weekly psychotherapy reimbursed at a reasonable rate. I think Abilify, before it was its patent expired, for cost something in the region of $700 or $800 a month or more to fulfill, you know, a prescription. So up until recently, the vast majority of mental health funds was going into medication, you know, covering the cost of medication for people. That shifting some, but it's really hard to accurately answer that question, because what doesn't get factored in is something called the medical cost offset research. If you think about it this way, if someone has a trusted therapist that they're seeing weekly, and let's just say for argument's sake, at a reasonable rate, these days the average reimbursement rate the insurers will reimburse psychotherapists is something around like $70 or $80. Let's say we go with that. It's far less expensive to have people have a liberal psychotherapy coverage, because then there's that, and then there's the saved money on avoidable medical costs. It's far cheaper. So a lot of it's been shown that for every dollar spent in mental health, there's about a $4 savings and an avoidable medical cost and lost productivity. So people will, if they have an option of going to a therapist, are less likely to go to a cardiologist because they think they're having a heart attack when it's really a panic attack, or they're less likely to anxiously get preoccupied about their health and medicalize psychological issues and get expensive MRIs and other costly medical procedures. So these kinds of what's called medical offset data need to be factored into the savings that a liberal mental health coverage will yield, and psychotherapy in particular.
I'm speaking with the author of Saving Talk Therapy. Enrico Gnaldi is my guest. He's a clinical psychologist, and my name is Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in terms of discussing the coverage of this treatment or that, and the advent of managed care health plans had a great deal of effect in the prescribing or not of talk therapy in the U.S. Can you tell us about the rise of managed care and how directly managed care shaped the degree to which talk therapy was practiced in the U.S.?
It, you know, when managed care hit the scene, and it coincided with, you know, the release of Prozac. So we're talking the late 80s, early 90s. Unfortunately, that was the time that I was graduating from graduate school and hanging out my shingle as a clinical psychologist. So I was, you know, practicing in fear and dread that I would be rendered obsolete by Prozac on the one hand, and then nickel and dime by managed care companies on the other end. I remember back in the mid-90s when I was first starting out, I was on provider lists, you know, with insurance companies that literally required that after every third or fourth session that I fax in a treatment plan to them, specifying all that I had done to, and it was a medical procedure essentially. It was all looking at client symptoms, whether or not I had gotten the client on medication, or proposed that they be on medication, or pushed for them to be on medication, and constantly estimating how many more sessions it would take for them to discontinue therapy. There was a level of accountability that was chilling back in the 90s. That sort of gave way in the late 90s and then in the turn of the century to a little bit more less red tape, but putting caps on sessions. So they would, like, it was not uncommon for managed care companies to have allow for 20 sessions and then require a whole utilization review process before any more were approved. You had that going on. I think it was 2010, maybe a little earlier than that, where you started to get the federal parity laws that came into place, which really needed to happen and that had a beneficial effects in the delivery of mental health care, where the federal government required through the parity laws that mental health services be covered at the same level as regular health problems. And so insurance companies backed off some, and then they relied on what's called medical necessity as a criteria for approving of sessions. And that's the procedure that goes on currently. And it's really disproportionately enforced with mental health. There's studies that show that mental health services or psychotherapy for mental health is denied for medical necessity reasons about six times more frequently than medical services are denied. So you've got that going on. So like, for instance, right now there are insurance companies that I deal with where I get paperwork, I'm required to get on the phone with an utilization review specialist, And the discussion is all about, is my psychotherapy I'm offering medically necessary in order for the client, you know, in order to approve additional sessions? So that's becoming more common. But there's something that's a little bit more insidious, a little bit more pernicious, that is affecting where insurance companies are underfunding mental health care. Reimbursement rates to psychotherapists have been stagnant or remain flat in like 30 years. The insurance companies know that there will be an overabundance of beginning therapists who are starting out in practice, who will agree to be on panels, insurance panels, that then the reimbursement rate when you're on an insurance panel is woefully low. And so what ends up happening is a lot of people will try to get a therapist in network, someone who's on their provider list. Not uncommonly, it's extraordinarily difficult to find someone who's skilled on the list, and multiple calls are made, oftentimes not returned, oftentimes returned with a statement that the therapist has a large waiting list. And so lots and lots of clients will go out of network to pay out of pocket for their own care, for their own psychotherapy care. And what that does is that then they deny themselves or reduce their own psychotherapy for economic reasons.
You just mentioned new therapists coming into the job market, and I wanted to ask you about the orientation that those therapists have, given the shifts cultural and within the profession that have taken place over the last 30 or so years. What kind of training do therapists get today when they come into the workforce as a new therapist? To what degree, if they were able to, if they weren't constrained by the constraints you're describing about insurance companies and so on, to what degree would they be able to practice more traditional talk therapy?
Well, therein lies the rub. I think that, unfortunately, we've got a new generation of therapists, especially psychologists, who in graduate school really have no choice but to buy into the evidence-based zeitgeist and to expose themselves to and be trained in evidence-based models of care, not uncommonly these short-term protocol-driven types of therapy. So you have that going on within graduate school. And then out of graduate school, when therapists have to get training hours, they often, the vast majority of them, find themselves in the Veterans Administration, college counseling centers, community mental health centers, government-funded mental health facilities that oftentimes are tied to universities, oftentimes employ academics themselves. And the evidence-based zeitgeist of short-term quick-fix therapies that they ingest in graduate school, they continue to ingest in training sites, when they're acquiring hours towards licensure. And so, frankly, all the wrong things get emphasized in graduate school in the preceding years coming out of graduate school. And it's not really until therapists are free from the constraints of graduate school, their clinical training, believe it or not, that many, 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 many of themselves, sadly, ironically, absurdly, have to de-educate themselves of the need to be busy and productive in the room with clients just to sit calmly and serenely with a suffering person.
Well, one of the things that you write about in your book to do with the way that therapy is now practiced, some of it involves smartphone apps and web-based programs, which might surprise a lot of people. Can you describe how these now play a role in therapy today?
I'm not the person to be asking that question, Sasha. Unfortunately, I don't keep up on that, and I resist it. I'm kind of biased, and I mean, I see a place for them as an adjunct to therapy, but not as a form of therapy, and not as an integral part of therapy. Unfortunately, the short-term, more cognitive, behaviorally oriented, monitor your symptoms, identify positive behaviors that you, ameliorative behaviors that you can pursue. Those kinds of treatments can map more closely onto the new technologies, so that there's that they can almost, frankly, I oftentimes worry if we're shooting ourselves in the foot as a profession by oversaturated training in these models, because I think they can be substituted for more internet-based forms of sort of interventions and app-based forms of interventions. And I don't think that they will ever substitute for quality talk therapy with a flesh and blood, caring, thoughtful, well-trained therapist who's there in the room, following along, listening, and caring to care.
Well, let me end by asking you about the argument that you make about psychotherapy and the social good. You make an argument that the widespread accessibility of therapy does not just have an individual benefit, but that it has a larger social benefit, and that it can increase our empathy. Now, someone might hear that argument and say, well, couldn't therapy do just the opposite? Couldn't it enhance our more narcissistic attributes? Why would it lead to the expansion of empathy, which would then help society at large?
Well, you know, my own bias is that good talk therapy, where there's sustained empathy over time, where clients' own subjective experiences are recognized in ways, in sustained ways over time, makes a person less narcissistic. I think this is the misconception. People are narcissistic because they really haven't ever been adequately mirrored. Now I'm using kind of clinical terminology, where they feel compelled to constantly prove themselves, to constantly be larger than life in order to be loved, in order to be admired. And so that kind of, you know, obsessive need for outside recognition, when it's met in the appropriate way with empathy in the therapist's office over time, makes a person less narcissistic, more humble, more capable of giving and receiving love, more capable of being able to see the me and you and the you and me. And I think that quality therapy, where true empathy is manifested, actually makes people more empathic over time and less narcissistic, less self-involved.
Enrico Gnallotti, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sasha. It's been a pleasure.
I've been speaking with the author of Saving Talk Therapy, How Health Insurers, Big Pharma, and Slanted Science Are Ruining Good Mental Health Care. That's published by Beacon Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.